The reason for this unawareness of the frightening danger to our country and to the entire free world is simple. The masterminds behind this great conspiracy have absolute control of all of our mass communications media, especially television, the radio, the press, and Hollywood. They have the right and the power to manage the news, to tell us not the truth, but what they want us to believe. They have seized that power on orders from their masters of the great conspiracy.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's online politics show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. In the second hour, US fighters buzz an Iranian airliner over Syria. Illegal US presence in Syria? What are they doing there, these planes? They also caused injuries on board. And also China must retaliate, apparently, after the US closes the Houston consulate. And Pompeo, the US Secretary of State, says the US will no longer tolerate China. What does he mean by that, no longer tolerating China? I'm afraid you're going to have to, Pompeo. Goldman Sachs also pays $4 billion today in compensation over the 1MDB scandal in Singapore. It wrestles back control of its state in Singapore from the international Bilderberg banksters. And also, was lingerie chain Victoria's Secret owner Les Wexner the Epstein and Maxwell money man? That's what one of Maxwell and Epstein's cool girls, Maria Farmer, believes. And she's in conversation tonight here with Chile-based US journalist Whitney Webb. So, what was really poisoned in Salisbury? Was it the Skripals or was it US-UK-Russia relations? Those bungling Russians in Salisbury and the Skripal affair were the reason Theresa May's government passed the UK version of the 2012 US Magnitsky Act in May 2018. This allows UK authorities to name any person at any time with no appeal and no questions as a human rights abuser and money launderer. Wherever they are in the world, their UK assets are frozen and their visas are rescinded. So, first tonight, why the Salisbury story can't possibly be true. And a pandemic to cover the bailout. His website is thirdalliance.ch. His book, Grand Deception, The Truth About Bill Browder, The Magnitsky Act and Anti-Russia Sanctions. That was published in 2018. And that is Alex Craner. We'll be hearing from him in the second hour after 6 o'clock. But joining me to review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello.
And we're in actually back in a studio for the first time since the pandemic started, aren't we, rather than sitting at home with our dodgy mics.
Indeed.
So first, is there anything you'd like to draw attention to this week? Particularly, I think the Labour Party has been going through a few problems, hasn't it? Particularly with Keir Starmer. And the new regime starting to turn its guns on Corbyn, and included in that is the BBC Panorama editor, managing editor, I think he is now, John Ware.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, Starmer has been asserting his authority this week in various ways. They decided to settle out of court, the Labour Party, with the various former employees who claim to be whistleblowers exposing anti-Semitism in the party. According to Jeremy Corbyn, the party's legal advisers were pretty certain that they could win any libel action that they took against the party. But Keir Starmer has decided to give them a massive chunk, we don't exactly know how much, of Labour Party funds and an apology. But of course what Corbyn has done, piping up from the back, is to say that he's not very happy with that decision. And of course then John Ware, who's the Panorama producer, has now threatened to sue Corbyn, and Corbyn basically has raised $100,000 in the last 24 hours for a court case. Oh. So if Keir Starmer thought he was going to make this all go away by paying these people off, it's rather backfired.
It will, and if it does backfire, this could be really problematic for the Labour Party. It'd be absolute turmoil over the next few months as the various factions are infighting instead of fighting the Tories.
Yes, it's very unfortunate, and in many ways Starmer could have made a better fist of trying to bring the party together. But I think he sees his role as to, you know, ring the changes. So that in, this morning I was on RT being interviewed about the other thing that he did this week, which is at Prime Minister's Questions, he called for the Prime Minister to ban RT, which isn't within the Prime Minister's power, in fact. But they've also written a letter, I understand, to Ofcom. This is from the Labour front bench, saying that they want a meeting with Ofcom to discuss why RT hasn't been banned. And, of course, it hasn't been banned because Ofcom, up to now, have been satisfied with the way they've fulfilled their obligations. But the Labour Party obviously want to make an issue of it. And both incidents really demonstrate that Starmer... he was a bit of an unknown quantity, and we can now sort of get a picture of where he wants to go.
Who you voted for? Are you regretting that yet?
Not really. I think we didn't have much of an option. Rebecca Long Bailey, if she'd committed to proportional representation, she could have beaten Starmer, but she wasn't prepared to do that. And you see, John Landsman, who was one of the founders of Momentum, and of course he's got a Jewish background, he's come out and supported Starmer's apology. But I can tell you now, there's lots and lots of grassroots Labour activists who are very angry about this.
Well, this is mostly...
Because this is their money,
you know,
that's
what,
being thrown down.
This is mostly... It's very, very interesting that all these people have then come back immediately and said, here's some money for Corbyn. That's very significant. And also, many of the people who are going to be annoyed about this are the hundreds of thousands that joined the Labour Party under the Corbyn wave.
That's right. I mean, I was talking to James Boswell, who's up in Sheffield, and he was threatening to resign from the party, and I just said, well, that's part of the strategy. If lots of left-wing people get so angry with Starmer,
well, this is
about
what happened
this,
under Blair.
That's right, they'll all resign. But, I mean, that's never been my view. You shouldn't resign. If they've got it wrong, they've got it wrong. You should stay and fight with them. Just don't make it too easy for them, basically.
OK, so William, let's take those two incidents one by one. First of all, the Keir Starmer and his... Keir Starmer and his attempt to... Russia Today. We'll do that one second. But first, let's have a listen. I thought would be one of the best places to do this would be through listening to the Richie Allen show on Wednesday. He did quite a good job. He's one of the, a bit like us, you know, sort of last man standing characters. And I go on his show from time to time and he does mine. But here he is saying what the mainstream media won't say about this stuff as he talks to... about the Panorama show and the comparison and compensation, rather. And he has a little clip from Lisa Nandy too on there on Wednesday.
Speaking of the Labour Party, it has agreed to give substantial damages to 7 former employees who sued the party in this never-ending saga about anti-Semitism. You remember the Panorama programme last year. The party, Labour, has issued an unreserved apology in the High Court for making false and defamatory comments about these alleged whistleblowers. Now, back in July of last year, the Panorama programme, which was called Is Labour Anti-Semitic? That programme basically showed or displayed or featured a number of former party officials. And those former party officials alleged that senior figures close to Corbyn at the time interfered in the process of dealing with anti-Semitism complaints. They also claimed they faced a huge increase in complaints since Jeremy Corbyn became leader in 2015. At the time, Labour said these were disaffected former staff who had personal and political access to grind. And they were accused, were these whistleblowers, of trying to undermine Jeremy Corbyn. Now today, Corbyn said the decision to settle the claims with an apology and damages was disappointing. He said the party's legal advice was that it had a strong defence. He was echoed, was Corbyn, by union leader Len McCluskey. We can hear from the Shadow Foreign Secretary, Lisa Nandy, from Wigan, Lisa Nandy. Here's Lisa Nandy speaking to BBC Politics Today. She's overjoyed that we can put this anti-Semitism behind us?
Well, I just really welcome this. I was one of the very many people in the Labour Party who spoke out about the treatment of those whistleblowers. And I think this is a welcome step forward that shows that Labour is now taking this seriously justice is being done. We've acknowledged that we got it wrong. That is the right thing to do. And we're taking steps today to set it right.
Not everyone on the left agrees with you. I think we can show our viewers this tweet from Len McCluskey, General Secretary of the Unite Union. He says today's settlement is a misuse of Labour Party funds. It could be in the region of £200,000. To settle a case, it was advised we could win in court. We would win in court. The leaked report on how anti-Semitism was handled tells a very different story about what happened. What do you say to that?
Yeah, powerful stuff from Len McCluskey.
That.
Well, I would just say that I believe that Len is completely wrong.
Well, you've got to say that, love. No career in politics for you if you disagree, if you agree with him. And you disagree with these whistleblowers who had no evidence, really, that there was any interference in any anti-Semitism investigation. But, of course, your career is ruined if you don't stand alongside the Zionist element of UK lobbyists in Westminster. You've got to say, oh, it's terrible, yeah, and I'm delighted that we've given these people money. Otherwise, you're finished, Lisa.
About that.
And that's how it works.
And that the way that a number of Labour Party staff, some very long-standing, some very young and new, who has...
Yeah. These allegations were baseless, without any foundation whatsoever, and they were only to destroy and bring down Jeremy Corbyn, whom I, as you well know, have no time for whatsoever. No Labour supporter am I. Anyway, Lisa Nandy there.
So that's the Richie Allen Show, talking to Lisa Nandy about the interference, so-called interference, in the anti-Semitism investigation. Martin, this was looked at by Panorama. Was there any interference in the anti-Semitism investigation by Corbyn and his friends?
Well, I mean, the party's lawyers thought that they could win any such case. And what's happened here is an attempt to railroad people, basically. But, of course, it's failed because Corbyn, bless his cotton socks, has spoken up and said he's not happy with the decision. And John Ware, from Panorama, is going to sue him. But, of course, Corbyn has already got a fighting fund of 100 grand since Wednesday in order to go to court. And, of course, they should have gone to court. He'll have to go to court as an individual now. But, of course, this will all come out because the party's contention was that these people basically didn't fulfil their employment contracts. They were basically sabotaging what was going on and spreading fibs about the party's anti-Semitic views. And, of course, it's become a trope in mainstream politics that the party's anti-Semitic. What really is going on here? We know from the Al Jazeera sting that was done some years ago, where they basically filmed people from this Panorama programme who were working for the Labour Party, colluding with Mossad agents to sabotage Corbyn. And there it all was, on film.
That's Al Jazeera, the lobby, if you're looking for it online. You'd probably best not use Google. It might still pop up there.
If it comes to court, that will be one of the things that could be used to undermine their position.
John Ware is an interesting figure, isn't he? Because he's the BBC producer that's made this documentary. He took over Panorama in the 1970s after doing what everyone was patting him on the back for at World in Action at Granada Television. This is going back a long, long way, and he goes back to there. And he did in 1973 an investigation into Nazi war criminals in South America, the sort of stuff we do. But the only thing is, he found Dr. Mengele, and he didn't find anybody else, because the year before, Stuart Stephen, the former Western Daily Press and also foreign editor of the Daily Express, had uncovered Martin Bormann living in South America. But so in a way, what Ware was doing with this World in Action film was saying, oh, let's just forget about Bormann, let's concentrate on Mengele. But he was annoying the Zionist lobby anyway, because he was going around under his normal name and his real name. And that may be why, you know, to this day, we think of Mengele as the Nazi war criminal hiding in South America, Martin, rather than Martin Bormann. That's all down to John Ware.
Yeah, he's an interesting character, definitely an insider. I think his most interesting work for Panorama was the exposure of Brigadier Gordon Kerr and the Force Research Unit in Northern Ireland, and their close links with the UDA's Chief Intelligence Officer, Brian Nelson, who subsequently supposedly died but basically disappeared. In other words, what was exposed there was that the British Army were running the Loyalist paramilitary terror campaign. That's quite significant, and it was quite a good piece of journalism. But of course, nothing was ever done. Brigadier Gordon Kerr was not arrested, although he was looked into by Sir John Stevens of the Metropolitan Police. And of course, the Stalker also had a look at some of these things that they were up to. But of course, that's what happens. Even when you've got a good piece of journalism, it doesn't have any effect. People ignore it, and they just carry on as if nothing had happened. Although I do remember John Ware doorstepping Brigadier Gordon Kerr in Beijing, because he'd been sent to be a military attaché in Beijing, and John Ware turned up on the doorstep and started to ask him about
the UDA. Well, that's it. I suppose he'd been sort of hoofed out of the army into MI6.
He wasn't hoofed out of the army. He was just sent to Beijing so that nobody could interview
him.
Okay, so Ware went over there to find him.
His army cover is quite nice for MI6, who can do all sorts of things illegal under British law.
Well, I don't know whether... The Force Research Unit was a very deep state unit, and it possibly wasn't directly related to MI6. The army's got its own deep state agents.
Well, I'm saying that's what he was doing in Beijing. He'd become a bit of a hot potato.
Well, no, they'd moved him to Beijing so that nobody could get hold of him, because who's going to... I mean, what, John Ware, presumably on BBC expenses, flew to Beijing and knocked on his door and said, excuse me, I want to ask you about the UDA. And, of course, what he did is he just slammed the door in his face and went back into the embassy.
So the other problem with, apparently, with... the Labour Party scandal, anyway, they're revealing this week, is the Russia collaboration story. And this is where the Tory party are actually collaborating, apparently, with Russians. And this is all related, I suppose, to the Intelligence and Security Committee report, which was supposed to come out last year, but it's taken a little while. And we can talk about that in a minute. But first of all, Prime Minister's questions, the Tory-Russia collaborators were discussed.
Ben Bradshaw. Mr. Speaker, I was the first member of this House to raise concerns about Russian interference in our democracy 4 years ago. By blocking the publication of the Russia report before the election on the grounds that the ISC committee has said were spurious, and then trying to fix the committee, isn't it abundantly clear that this Prime Minister has knowingly and repeatedly put his own personal and party interests before the national security of our country?
No, Mr. Speaker, and I think that's a pretty lamentable way of looking at it, lamentable question, because, after all, if he thought there was genuinely something in the ISC report that showed that, for instance, the Brexit referendum had been undermined by Russia, then he would now be saying it, but that doesn't appear. And I'm afraid what you have here, as I'm afraid I've told the House several times, is the rage and fury of the Remainer elite, finding that there is in fact nothing in this report, and no smoking gun whatever, after all that froth and fury. And suddenly, all those who want to remain in the EU find that they have no argument to stand on. And I regret that they should simply move on.
So with this Russia collaboration report, Martin, do you think it's that it was commissioned under one government, it's been published under another, and that there's been a certain amount of rubbing out been going on, some rubbers going and certain bits of it being deleted in the meantime?
Well, it was obviously heavily redacted. And in fact, as they were saying on RT this morning when I was on the show, on their shows, it's been redacted. And the bit that's been redacted is the bit about Russian interference in the elections. So, and if they're not going to tell us what that bit is, then it's not really much to, there's not really much
well,
to say
hope,
about
we're
it,
hoping
there?
For the evidence to be produced.
Well, no, but that's
that
the bit, that's
then
the, that's
start
the bit
taking
that
they, that, it seriously well, rather than
yes.
all just hearsay.
Well, I think it's a big nothing burger, really. I mean, I was expecting there would be more sensational allegations in it, but there's hardly anything in it. What's in it? What's left of it when you look at it is the fact that various wealthy Russians are donators to the Conservative Party. one of Putin's minor minister's wives, who's a British citizen, paid $200,000 to play tennis with Boris, presumably on the grounds that if she, you know, he has to let her win or something. But I mean, that, you know, wealthy people from all over the world, as long as they've got British passports, give money to the Tory party, including wealthy Russians, many of whom, of course, like one of them, a totally anti-Putin oligarch, and he's given money to the Tory party.
Well,
not surprising.
The suspicion here is that this money is just simply there to buy favours. The Russians are buying favours in the Tory party. Isn't that what's going on?
Yeah, but we're not talking about the Russian government. We're talking about wealthy Russians. And, of course, this is the whole thing about Putin's so-called gangster state. The wealthy elite in Russia, which robbed the society blind during the 1990s, they've all got their kids at Eton, and they've all got their penthouse flats in Kensington. And they fly backwards and forwards to Moscow all the time, and they invest a lot in British industry and finance, and they hobnob with top wealthy people, including top Tory politicians, and there's no real surprise there. But these people aren't, in fact, Putin. Some of them are, because business people, they just try and get on everybody's right side, but most of them are anti-Putin. And of course, it's therefore, on what basis are we accusing the Russian government of interfering? The Russian government hasn't interfered. The people who don't like Putin have been giving money to the Tory party, and that's rather embarrassing.
Also, the former ambassador, Craig Murray, has pointed out that he's had a look at this report, and there's actually nothing in it that's got anything to do with the secret intelligence services at all. It's actually all stuff that's been in the public domain.
That's right. And of course,
so why is the Intelligence and Security Committee even involved?
Well, it's because there was a lot of hoo-ha about the Russians are doing this, the Russians are doing that, so they commissioned a report. And of course, the main line taken in
and
the,
they came back with nothing.
Well, they came back with nothing, because the intelligence services, that if you read Marina Hyde and others in The Guardian, the intelligence services are in the firing line because they didn't investigate stuff that wasn't happening. And of course, they should have investigated the stuff that wasn't happening, and therefore they're to blame and complacent, and therefore they should have more powers to investigate stuff, because they basically concentrated their time on focusing on things that were happening. I think, in any case, most rational adults will think, well, what realistic influence could Russia have over a British election? Even if they had a massive war chest, what would they spend it on, and what sort of result would they...
Well, they might advertise on Facebook, because there's all sorts of things. Well, Martin, let's go to Prime Minister's questions now, because mm-hmm. Keir Starmer brought this up at PMQs, and here he is talking about this, you know, his view of this Russian election interference report, and of course the most important thing of it, from many people's point of view, is that it may be that the Russians changed the result, or the influence of the Russians changed the result of the Brexit referendum. But let's have a listen now to Starmer at PMQs.
This is a serious question. A serious question of national security. The Prime Minister sat on this report for 10 months and failed to plug a gap in our law on national security for a year and a half. Mr. Speaker, one of the starkest conclusions in the report is that the UK is clearly a target for Russian disinformation campaigns. The report also highlights that this is being met with a fragmented response across Whitehall and across the government. The report refers to this as a hot potato, with no one organisation recognising itself as having the overall lead. That's a serious gap in our defences. This is not about powers, it's about responsibility, Prime Minister. So how is the Prime Minister going to address that gap and make sure the UK meets this threat with the joined-up, robust response it deserves?
Mr. Speaker, there is no other government in the world that takes some more robust steps to protect our democracy, to protect our critical national infrastructure, and to protect our intellectual property, as I have said, from interference by Russia or by anyone else. And frankly, I think that everybody understands that these criticisms are motivated by a desire to undermine the referendum on the European Union, the membership of the European Union, that took place in 2016, the result of which he simply cannot bring himself to accept.
Well, that's as maybe, but Martin, he's pointing out there, Starmer, that we have this enormous gap in our security, this enormous gap in our defences, although the Intelligence and Security Committee haven't presented any evidence that gap is being exploited by the Russians.
Well, I mean, as I said this morning, this whole idea that the Russians are influencing Western democracies really took off with the idea that they'd hacked the Democratic National Committee's computers and then passed on to WikiLeaks everything that was found there, which showed that the in the run-up to the 2016 election that Bernie Sanders was being basically sabotaged by the DNC National Committee. They were rigging the primary election.
But they seem to have done that this time with Biden. Well, they got rid of Sanders.
Well, the problem is that was his best chance, Sanders, the last time. And, of course, this time it was difficult for him to get the same momentum. But what they did, I mean, the way they dealt with this is instead of looking at the actual emails and what they showed, they immediately started this hue and cry, there's a squirrel, the Russians must have hacked this out, it's so damaging and it gives such a bad impression of US democracy, this must be a foreign power making us look bad. Now, of course, just logically, that's just wrong. Even if the Russians had hacked it out, and of course they didn't, Craig Murray actually got an MP3 from the insider that gave it to him, possibly Seth Rich, who then died in a very mysterious non-robbery. The fundamental problem with it is that they're not actually addressing the real problem, which is that US democracy is rigged. And it's not the Russians who are rigging it, and it's not the Russian intelligence services who are rigging it, it's the Western intelligence services. And when they get caught, they immediately scream, it's the Russians,
it's
the Russians.
Well, it's interesting you mentioning hacking there, because this is, obviously, this is the way that they're going, but there is hacking going on. And it does worry me that, and we picked up on this, it was, I was having a listen in the car to the Alex Thompson interview, which is last week we did with the former GCHQ officer, Alex Thompson. You can go back and find that if you want on thisweek.org.uk for what was it? I think the 20th of July show. 17th of July show. But what he pointed out on that programme, so just a quick clip back from last week's, which I hadn't picked up on at the time, is that the way that, okay, so we've got these Five Eyes intelligence services, including GCHQ, the NSA, etc., the signals intelligence people, keeping an eye on things. But the involvement of the Israelis is particularly pernicious because their version, Unit 8200, is not officially declared, so we're talking about Six Eyes rather than Five. And not only that, but the Israeli unit is also involved, and they're quite proud of their ability to alter information whilst it's on people's computers, delete files and this sort of thing. And I've mentioned this because I've noticed some of my files being deleted recently. You know, you go back and think, well, where's that email? It's just completely disappeared. I mean, I've got a proprietary email. It doesn't sit on the internet. It sits on my computer, but the email's been deleted somehow. And so let's have a listen, a review, Martin, to this whole idea of hacking by the intelligence services and the Israeli intelligence, Unit 8200, potentially, anyway, using the Six Eyes, undeclared Six Eyes, to get away with doing things like that in other parts of the world. So let's have a listen to that clip from last week's interview with Alex now.
And there's also a very under-discussed Israeli angle to all this, which we see popping up in areas such as recently when the National Health Service for Britain, and particularly its data and technical arm, NHSX, started partnering with GCHQ. And who's in the background of that? Matthew Gould, former British ambassador in Tel Aviv. And then we get some very strange links going through to Unit 8200, the Israeli Signals Intelligence Agency, which actually is also active. It does things that would be unlawful and illegal in Britain and America, which is actually fiddled with data while it's not in transit, which would be breaking the terms of the statutory bounds of only looking at communications. So more hacking and shaping views among the public. Something the Third Reich also did with its intelligence agency, particularly the Signals Intelligence Bureau, did that.
Naughty, naughty Alex Thompson there, who has a regular slot, I think it's once a week, on the UK column, in which comes out of Plymouth, pretty much daily at lunchtimes. They have a programme. But Martin, what the point he's making there is pretty devastating, isn't he? He's saying that actually this hacking is going on, potentially by intelligence services, with the collaboration of the top people in the British, American, Canadian, New Zealand, Australian intelligence services too. And the idea that it might be, in fact, it is illegal for it to happen in Britain. Legalities don't allow it. It's easy enough for them to farm it out so that someone else can be using this. But the point here being that, you know, this could be happening to MPs' computers. lawyers' computers, journalists' computers too.
Yeah, I think anybody who thinks that you're using any electronic equipment that you're not hackable has missed the point. And of course, the
state hacking is something else, isn't
it? Oh yeah, well, I mean, and they can say that it's illegal and we don't do it, but do you believe them? And in any case, the way they got around the legalities, as you say, is that the British spy on the Americans and then give it to the Americans, and the Americans spy on the British and then give it to the British. So it's not, in fact, the British who are spying on us directly. It'll be the US but, and the Israelis.
Aren't these institutions supposed to be spying on our enemies, not on us?
Well, the whole point of it, I mean, unless you're not going to have intelligence services at all, and there's a case for that. I mean, maybe the police should do everything. Why do you need intelligence services? There is a case for intelligence services doing specialised stuff.
Well, the police are more accountable for stuff.
Well, that's why they have, but in any case, intelligence services used to be there simply to collect information to pass to the political leadership. But once the CIA was set up in the 1940s, the British had done this for years and they just blooded them in. You're there to actually steer events.
Yeah, covert operations.
Covert operations. You're not just collecting information. You're actually trying to steer things in the direction you want to go.
Well, let's try and steer things back to the Keir Starmer at Prime Minister's Questions, where he's talking about Russians having a licence for disinformation using a certain programme, which you were on earlier today, Martin, called Russia Today.
A serious gap in our Official Secrets Act, laying bare for 18 months, and that's all the Prime Minister has to say about it. Yeah. One way the government can seek to clamp down on Russian influence is to prevent the spread of Kremlin-backed disinformation. Obviously, social media companies have a big role to play, but the report also highlights serious distortions in the coverage provided by Russian state-owned international broadcasters such as Russia Today. The High Court has ruled that Russia Today broadcasts pose actual and potential harm. Does the Prime Minister agree with me that it's time to look again at the licensing for Russia Today to operate in the UK?
Mr. Speaker, I think this would come more credibly from the Leader of the Opposition had he called out the former Leader of the Opposition when he took money for appearing on Russia Today. I mean, Mr. Speaker, he protested neither against the former Leader of the Opposition's stance on Salisbury nor against his willingness to take money from Russia Today. He flip-flops from day to day, Mr. Speaker. One day he's in favour of staying in the EU, the next day he's willing to accept Brexit. Mr. Speaker, the Leader of the Opposition has more flip-flops than Bournemouth Beach.
Flip-flops, Alexander Stafford. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Last week, the party opposite bravely abstained on a vote that attempted to tie us into the EU indefinitely, further highlighting the increasing detachment of Labour from the old heartlands like Rother Valley. Can my right honourable friend, the Prime Minister, confirm that we on this side of the House remain fully committed to delivering our promises to the British people and are restoring our full economic independence on the 1st of January so the people of Thurcroft, Maltby, Diddington and across Rother Valley get the Brexit bonanza and level up that we so deserve?
Yeah, so the main part of that was the first part of the question. We didn't really need the second one. But, Martin, this is Keir Starmer really going to the right of Boris here, saying, look, we should cut off the broadcast licence for Russia Today. He doesn't want to hear what you've got to say this morning, for example.
Well, as I pointed out this morning, another journalist on Russia Today pointed out this morning, it's not up to the Prime Minister to decide who's allowed to broadcast.
No, but he can send a strong letter to Ofcom, can't he?
Yes, but Ofcom are supposed to be above political pressure. If they're in a situation where
you can bet there's political appointments there.
Well, indeed, but the point is, officially, it may well be that arms can be twisted and testicles can be crushed behind the scenes, but officially, Ofcom decides, not the Prime Minister. Even if Keir Starmer was the Prime Minister, he's not in a position to close down journalistic outlets.
Why is he trying to shut the mouth of the English language Russia broadcasters like you?
Because basically, there's a huge deep state project to continue conflict between Russia and the West. It's called Operation Beluga. We know it's called Operation Beluga because Paul Borel, who's a former head of the French anti-terrorist squad and used to be in Berezovsky's, in London, Berezovsky's protection squad, He said whenever there is a possibility of a serious discussion between Russians and the West, then the intelligence services come up with various stunts to prevent it from happening.
Well, the Russians, to be fair to them, on Wednesday just came up with one word reply, didn't they? This is Russophobia.
Yeah, I mean, basically...
They didn't bother to really try and explain.
Well, I mean, because there's nothing to it. I mean, Russia today has had various run-ins with Ofcom, and Ofcom have ticked them off in various ways, and they've tried to work within the rules. And they, as far as they're concerned, the rules are there, and they're prepared to abide within those rules. But you can't have a situation where politicians, that's what we're talking about, can tell the independent regulator of journalistic endeavour on TV and etc. Because it doesn't cover written journalism. Anybody can write any old rubbish in a newspaper, and you can't be sued. You can't unless you've libelled somebody. The government certainly doesn't demand that the Daily Mail give Jeremy Corbyn a fair go and a right of reply.
Why is the leader of the Labour opposition trying to muzzle media that he doesn't agree with?
Because they're basically trying to...
I mean, there's the Daily Mail as well, isn't there? Why doesn't he try and shut the Daily Mail up?
Well, because he can't. It's only because RT is a TV station that they have to fulfil various criteria. And I think that's fair enough. I mean, if you want to be a TV station, I think you should have to fulfil various criteria. But it doesn't mean that you've got to say what everybody else wants you to say. The whole point of having pluralism in the media is nobody forces you to watch RT. If you don't like it, you can switch over and watch Fox News or BBC.
Five years.
France 24 or anything you like, can't
5 years or so ago, the Iranian English language broadcaster Press TV, which I do stuff for still from time to time, they were completely banned as well. So we've got a bizarre situation here where we are acting a little bit like the Nazis were in the Second World War, because they were the ones that started banning foreign broadcasts all the way through World War II. The British allowed Lord Haw to broadcast from Radio Luxembourg in English with German propaganda right the way through the war. There was a discussion and a debate about whether they should try and jam it, and they said no, what we'll do is we'll just point out the misinformation that the Germans are giving, and we'll also ridicule it. So they didn't want to do any banning, but we now do.
Yeah, I think part of the problem is that RT has got quite a dynamic audience of younger people. It's got a livelier presentational style. The Kaiser Report is far more informative about what's happening in financial markets than the dreary dollops of BBC, etc. And it's actually quite effective in communicating the Russian point of view. And I think surely in the modern world, we need to hear the Russian point of view.
Well,
we need to hear the Chinese point of view.
For example, Martin, we had Ian Fraser on this programme a few years ago, the freelance columnist. I think it was for the Glasgow Herald. He writes quite a lot. He was saying the big problem with financial journalism in London is that all of the financial journalists in London, that is to say all of the staffers for the main London media, are all far, far too close to the institutions they're supposed to be reporting on. So they're just not critical anymore. They just tell the viewers and listeners what the industry wants them to hear.
That's right.
So they're like doing PR, basically.
That's right. And of course, RT has actually made finance exciting and interesting to a younger audience, because they've got a different presentational style, and it's also very informative. Now, of course, they don't like that. They don't like it up them. Then, the BBC doesn't like having competition. And, of course, they've been shown up, for example, over the BBC Russia sent their Russian correspondents into Ukraine after the MH17 shootdown to talk to locals on the ground, who all informed them that the plane had been shot down by aircraft from Kiev, by fighter aircraft. That was put up on BBC Russia's Moscow website. Of course, most people in England don't read Russian, so they didn't even realise. And then as soon as BBC London realised that BBC Russia had put this up, they took it down. But of course, it's there, out there in the world of internet. And of course, it completely disproved the theory that it had been shot down by a Russian missile.
I mean, I found myself this week wondering, why is it that Russia seems to be so important? Why this Russophobia? Why are we going to make up all these stories about how terrible Russia is? At least, you know, it wouldn't be so bad if there was actually any evidence to back it up. It just seems almost fevered to me. But then I start thinking, well, actually, it's because in a potential coming conflict between the United States and China, whether that be economic or a shooting war, actually, the Chinese, Martin, the Russians could be the crucial third player.
Well, I think that they turned against the Russians. Putin was originally regarded as one of their men. And when he first came to power, I was very suspicious of Putin because I thought he's just an enforcer for the IMF gangsters. But of course,
well, that's what Berezovsky thought when he put him there.
That's what Berezovsky thought when he put him there. That's right. And of course, Berezovsky ultimately committed suicide, supposedly in Surrey, although the local coroner wouldn't accept that he committed suicide.
And it'd be interesting to see what Paul Burrell had to say about that, having worked with him.
And that's right. And of course, in actual fact, you'd have thought Berezovsky being an enemy of Putin and he commits suicide, but the coroner won't accept that it's suicide. They should have been screaming on the front Daily Mail headlines, you know, Berezovsky murdered by Putin. But of course, they didn't do that because he wasn't murdered by Putin, but he was murdered. And, of course, his daughter believes that he was murdered by the British. And I don't suppose anybody in West Belfast is surprised that the British murder people. But, of course, in Middle England, we don't do stuff like that. So, ipso facto, it must be the Russians. But, of course, that's just wrong. The British spycraft is very sophisticated, and they do wet work as well as other work.
And also, I mean, with the whole Skripal business, I mean, looking at that, you do wonder what the point of that was. It looked to me as if Sergei Skripal was trying to leave Britain, and because this is what we'll be talking a bit about this in the second hour, is he was trying to leave Britain. There was a letter published in the Independent newspaper or an article a few weeks after the Skripal incident saying, well, actually, he wanted to return to Russia. Now, that could have been a potential disaster, Martin, couldn't it? Because if he suddenly pops up on Russian TV saying, oh, yeah, I work with this guy called Christopher Steele and we put together a dossier about Trump and all sorts of sordid stuff, including interfering in US elections, that could be a bit embarrassing.
Yeah, it was probably more to do with the fact that he knew what had happened to Litvinenko. And Litvinenko wasn't murdered by the Russians either. I know it's surprising for people if you're in the mainstream, because we all know that the Russians did that. Although the polonium, I mean, why would you murder somebody with polonium, which is radioactive and can be traced? Nobody would do that in their right mind.
Yeah, Yasser Arafat, by the way, his toothbrush, found polonium on that.
Well, maybe. When the Metropolitan Police traced the polonium trail, it led back to Berezovsky's office. Because Berezovsky and criminals like him who used to run Russia in the 1990s, they were involved in all sorts of things like that. Selling nuclear materials, fixing elections, of carrying out false flag terrorist attacks. So Berezovsky is a very key person. And if he defected back to Russia, he would have a great deal of information about the disinformation campaigns run by the West.
The fascinating thing about this
is that couldn't be allowed, so he was snuffed.
That we've been, Skripal is what we're talking about now. Now, we've been left with the impression that actually he's sitting pretty here in Britain, he's having a nice time, and actually the real threats to him are the Russians. Actually, it could be the other way around.
It could be. I mean, it's very bizarre, isn't it? And both
imprisoned by MI6.
Yes, basically. Well, I mean, his daughter, don't forget, was engaged to be married in Russia and has not gone back to her fiancé. She's just disappeared. Extraordinary, you'd have thought.
So these people have apparently been disappeared. They've been disappeared for their own protection, apparently.
Yes, well, that may or may not be the case. I think what really is going on here is an ongoing attempt to blacken Russia, and therefore the whole Skripal affair in Salisbury is essentially theatre by the British intelligence services.
Okay, well, look, I thought we'd have a listen to Tuesday when this announcement was made's PM programme with, I call him Gollum, Evan Davis on the BBC giving the commentary, as he looks a bit like him on Newsnight. So let's have a listen now to the first clip from that, where they talk about this being kind of nihilistic paranoia that the Russians have about Britain.
Well, it's a big foreign policy day, big foreign policy week, really. Look at China in the news, Mike Pompeo here, and that Russia report. It's a take-stock moment for the country, and we're going to be taking stock towards the end of the programme. But on that Russia report, it has been long-awaited, an important take on maliciously intended disruption of public life here. So let's take a few minutes to examine it. Came from Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee, and here is a key line on what we're up against.
The security threat posed by Russia is difficult for the West to manage as, in our view and that of many others, it appears fundamentally nihilistic. Russia seems to see foreign policy as a zero-sum game. Any actions it can take which damage the West are fundamentally good for Russia. It is also seemingly fed by paranoia, believing that Western institutions such as NATO and the EU have a far more aggressive posture towards it than they do in reality.
Well, Russia, it is argued, thinks of the UK as a top target.
Russia's cyber capability, when combined with its willingness to deploy it in a malicious capacity, is a matter of grave concern and poses an immediate and urgent threat to our national security.
Urgent threat to national security, including in the report to critical infrastructure, it argues.
So, yes, urgent threat to national security, Martin, but no evidence for it. I find it fascinating that they use this word, that the Russians are nihilistic and that they're paranoid, because they're starting to move into almost philosophical and psychological areas, aren't evidenced by anything, really.
No, and of course, if you think about it, the idea of Russia as this other, this enemy of the British Empire, goes back to the 19th century. We don't want to fight, but by jingo, if we do... We've got the men, we've got the ships, we've got the bullets too, and the Russians shall not have Constantinople. That is a trope going back to the 19th century.
So what's the fundamental basis of this Russophobia then, if that's what this is?
Well, I mean, when we really started to get annoyed with the Russians, the West massively intervened in the 1990s in Russia. At one stage, Boris Yeltsin was narrowly, very, very narrowly re-elected because all these bombs went off in Ryazan and Moscow.
99, wasn't
it? Yeah. Well, 98. It was 98 election. But 99 is when the bombs went off. But in any case, there was massive intervention to prop up Yeltsin so that Western multinationals and their friends, you know, Magnitsky, who we're going to hear about later, Khodorkovsky, Berezovsky, and all of these Russian oligarchs, many of whom have dual Russian-Israeli citizenship, which is just a fact, were ripping off the country. And the Russians remember this very well. Living standards collapsed. The death rate massively shot up. The average age of death went down. So, you know,
the other thing about the oligarchs,
a terrible time for them.
I mean, we will be talking quite a lot more about the oligarchs in the second hour, but the other thing about them was that they had these basically open checkbooks from Swiss bank accounts.
That's right. I mean, we were perfectly happy with the Russian government when it was run by puppets of the West who would allow Western multinationals to do pretty much what they wanted and give them access to all of the goodies in Siberia. And Putin came to power through a fairly abstract process. And he basically put his foot down and said, we're not doing that. We're not giving our national assets to you for nothing.
Didn't. What do Intelligence and Security Committee mean when they say the Russians are nihilistic?
Well, the idea they've got is that anything that the Russians...
What does it mean?
Well, nihilism, in fact, is interesting. If you wonder the history of nihilism, in the 19th century, the great inventor of nihilism was Sergei... what was his name? It wasn't Pugachev. It was... I'll have to look it up.
Sergei, anyway, yeah.
Yep. And nihilism was, you know, that was part of the philosophical ferment in Russia in the run-up to the Russian Revolution. And the nihilists were very, like, extreme anarchists, really. And then, of course, it went into the general language as meaning people who were just negative about everything, just wanted to destroy, you know, and all of the rest of it. But of course, what's really...
Well, it's having no values, no morals.
Yeah, but which is...
Basically, isn't the idea that you just do whatever it takes and you don't think about...
Yeah, that's right.
But the
idea that Russians are basically nihilistic is fundamentally racist. Russia is a society like any others with interests, and it's got national interests, just as Britain has national interests.
Oh, so
it's
Sergei...
not nihilistic. It's, they've got very concrete goals.
I've just looked him up. He's Sergei Nechayev.
Nechayev, that's right. That's I've forgotten the name. And of course, he was a friend of Bakunin's, or he used to work in his circle, who's the founder of Russian anarchism, unless you include Kropotkin. But the point about this is they are projecting onto the Russians their own worldview. They are nihilistic about Russia. They don't see a Russia with its own goals and values as acceptable.
Martin, this is worrying. This is what psychopaths do. They project onto others their own psychological problems or their own misdemeanours.
Indeed. Well, it's not even misdemeanours. If you think about, we were talking earlier about the shoot down of MH17. That was carried out probably by Ukrainian aircraft. And it was a deliberate, they knew what they were doing, and they did it probably under the orders of Paribi, who was in charge of security at that stage, in order to force the West to bring sanctions in against Russia. The people that were shot down in the Maidan Square at the beginning of the crisis
in Ukraine,
there's been a court case in Ukraine where the Bearcut riot police were exonerated because the people who'd actually done the sniping and killed the 80-odd people testified, two of them testified from Georgia and said, we did that. We were flown in to Poland to the Warsaw Police Academy, and we then went to Kiev and we shot those people, and these people are innocent, and they had to let them go. That's a court case in Kiev, totally unreported.
Okay, well, let's get back to the Russian interference in the British elections report, which came out on Tuesday, and back to Evan Davis and PM, this time looking at this apparent idea of something called Londonograd, which is the financial influence.
Now, it also argues that too many Brits have responded to Putin's Russia by looking for commercial opportunity. Here's how Labour MP Kevin Jones, he's one of those on the committee, how he put it.
Successive governments have welcomed Russian oligarchs and their money with open arms. And there is a lot of Russians with very close links to Putin who are now very well integrated into both UK business, political and social scene in what has been referred to as Londongrad.
Londongrad. Well, as the report said, there are many hangers-on here.
The arrival of Russian money resulted in a growth industry of enablers, individuals and organisations who manage and lobby for the Russian elite in the UK. Lawyers, accountants, estate agents and PR professionals have played a role, wittingly or unwittingly, in the extension of Russian influence, which is often linked to promoting the nefarious interests of the Russian state.
They also pointed the finger at some members of the House of Lords, incidentally, and called Russian influence the new normal.
Still waiting, Martin, for anything substantial in this report. Nothing much there. That was a Labour MP, Kevin Jones, there, commenting, who's on the Intelligence and Security Committee. Lots and lots of innuendo, but nothing really substantial.
Well, what you've got to recognise is that you only get on the Security and Intelligence Committee if you're regarded as a safe pair of hands from the point of view of the British deep state. So you've got a lot of, basically, arse-lickers there.
OK, so let's get into a bit further into this report, into the former... there's two senior people who were involved, first of all, in the commissioning and secondly in the implementation of this report. First, the Tory old Intelligence and Security Committee chair, who was booted out by his constituents in the December general election. That's Dominic Grieve.
The report was written last year, and that was written by a committee of parliamentarians that has largely now changed because we had an election between it being written and now. But we can hear from the former chair of it, former MP Dominic Grieve, who was obviously there when it was being written. And a very good afternoon to you, Mr. Grieve.
Good afternoon. My interpretation is that the government's eye was off the ball. There was no desire... Firstly, it's perfectly clear that the close monitoring of the referendum in 2016, which one might have expected in view of the risks that were beginning to emerge from Russia's past record of interfering in democratic processes, doesn't appear to have taken place. Secondly, there appears to have been absolutely zero desire subsequently when it became plain that Russia was interfering in many democratic processes, not just in the United Kingdom, but elsewhere, to go back and revisit whether that had actually happened during the 2016 referendum.
Right. We didn't say, now, hey, I wonder if they did that here, given that they did it in the US.
Exactly. As to what the motive was, I think I would be rather careful. I'd be guarded, because there can be all sorts of motives.
Right.
But the simple fact is that it didn't happen. And our concern was that as part of I want to emphasize, this report was not just about Russia and elections. I know it's
no, 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 it's got all sorts of other stuff.
It's a much wider report. Mm. But as part of it, we did want to look about Russia and elections and Russia and subversion of democratic processes in democratic countries. And we were a bit startled when, having made the request for could you supply us with the information that you have on this particular subject, what actually arrived was extraordinarily limited, in fact, almost non-existent.
Right, a few lines and what had been on RT and Russian television.
And it was plain to us that this was a subject which was regarded as very delicate.
Right, but look,
now, there I have some sympathy with the agencies, because, you know, on the whole, in a democracy, you don't want agencies looking into your own internal democratic processes. But if they're threatened by external actors, we've got to look into it, and it should be a government priority, and it should be something which can be actually approached, and I'm sure can be approached, on a completely bipartisan basis.
Well, it's amazing, really, that Evan Davis didn't ask him anything about why there was no actual substance in this report, because even he, Dominic Grieve there, is admitting that there was nothing really in it.
Yes, and of course, what you're getting from Grieve and also from Marina Hyde in The Guardian and others is that MI5 and MI6 are to blame, because they should have found something, but it may well be that MI5 didn't look for it because there's nothing there. And they probably know that all this stuff about interference in elections, it all comes back to the supposed hack of the Democratic National Committee and the emails which showed that this was basically being rigged.
Well, look,
the evidence for that is zero.
Okay.
It's actually the opposite.
We're going to go from the one Dominic to another Dominic now. That's Dominic Grieve, who's out on his ear in the last general election, from being Attorney General, etc., to the new Dominic Raab, who's now Foreign Secretary. What does he make of this Russia report?
So, fingers pointed at Russia, fingers pointed at inadequate UK response. Let's get some responses. Russia always enjoys puncturing any British self-importance, and the line from the ambassador, Andrei Kellin, was to say that it excessively overestimates the role of Britain in Russian foreign policy. It does not have such a role in it, he told TASS. As for the government here, this afternoon, the Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, was asked whether the government had actively avoided looking for evidence of Russian interference into the Brexit referendum.
You mentioned the suggestion that the UK had actively avoided investigating Russia. I think, in fairness, you'll find that wasn't in the ISC report. It was the comment of one MP, Stuart Hosey, and we categorically reject that. I think if you look, we've got a long period recognising the enduring and significant threat posed by Russia to the UK, including in relation to cyber. Russia is a top national security priority.
Okay, so Martin, we're looking at this really bizarre situation here. I can't imagine it from all of our previous broadcasts and analysis of what's going on, that you've got the Labour Party being far more Russophobic and critical of Russia than the Conservatives. You would have thought that it would be the other way around, surely.
Well, not really. I mean, during the Yeltsin era, plenty of Russian oligarchs, as I say, established themselves over here.
Is it because they're jealous? Because the oligarchs tend to give money to the Tories, rather
Yeah, well,
than
I mean,
them.
as you can imagine, wealthy people tend to give money to the Tories, and therefore the Labour Party think that they can make some kind of hay out of this. But what's underlying all of this is just a refusal to understand the deviousness of their own deep state, the deep state that carried on a dirty war in Northern Ireland for 30 years. the deep state that is currently many of our military are over in Saudi Arabia, helping the Saudi military to butcher the Yemenis and the biggest humanitarian catastrophe on the planet. But we're not hearing anything about that. And about and don't forget the Saudis do say, they have their chaps all trained at Sandhurst. They're all at Cranwell being shown how to fly aeroplanes as we speak. Their kids all go to our schools, and we've got basically the wealthy elite of the world comes to this country to get to know the other wealthy elite people, and the Russians are no exception. And but many of them, like Berezovsky and others, are very hostile to Putin, but they're Russian. And of course the Russians are just nihilistic. They just hate our freedoms.
Okay, well, I think we'll leave Russia there for now, and concentrate for a while on the COVID-19 so-called pandemic. I did post plenty of stuff last week at thisweek.org.uk, and maybe I ought to do it all the time permanently, really, on the actual numbers. In Bristol, there was actually a news story this week where one person in Bristol had died, and they considered that to be news. And yet we're looking at the potential of having lockdowns here in Bristol, specific individual lockdowns, just because of people testing positive, Martin, even if they don't have any symptoms. So this is, we're getting into a very bizarre stage where there's people who are not ill, but they're causing citywide lockdowns potentially.
Well, I mean, if you look at successful countries that have dealt with this, like New Zealand, where they had 27 deaths, or Vietnam, where they had zero deaths, or China, where they've had less than 4,000 deaths, I think you'll find that the way the British establishment has handled this has been execrable. And, of course, we're now still not sorted. And the reason why anybody who shows positive, they can spread it to other people. And I'm afraid we're not out of the woods yet by a long way.
Okay, well, they can spread it to other people, but as we were hearing last week, for example, even kids that test positive are not spreading it because it doesn't it's not showing symptoms. They're not coughing, spluttering, etc. So you know, this is another aspect to this whole pandemic, so-called pandemic, which is extremely questionable. But anyway, I thought we'd have a listen now because we had a bit of entertaining stuff from Dr. Vernon Coleman last week. We have a listen to him now. Another section on elderly people, because he is very concerned about the way elderly people have been treated, and he thinks that particularly in care homes there's been lots and lots of totally unnecessary elderly people have been killed. And he also links it here to the pension companies, who rather don't like having to keep paying out pensions to lots of elderly living people.
The real tragedy here is, although this was the worst mass slaughter of the elderly in modern history, it isn't actually anything new. Old people have been murdered for years without anyone taking any notice. Euthanasia, sometimes admitted and sometimes not, is now commonly practiced in so-called civilized societies around the world, and the elderly are invariably the victims. For many years in the UK, doctors and nurses were encouraged to follow something called the Liverpool Care Pathway. This was a murderous charter which allowed doctors and nurses to withhold food, water, and essential treatment from patients who were over 65 and who were, therefore, regarded as an expensive and entirely disposable nuisance. Then the Liverpool Care Pathway was replaced by something called Sustainable Development Goals, which originated with the United Nations and which is, therefore, global. Sustainable Development Goals allows doctors and hospitals to discriminate against anyone over the age of 70 on the grounds that people who die when they're over 70 cannot be said to have died prematurely and so will not count when the nation's healthcare is being assessed. Governments everywhere love this new rule because it gives the state permission to get rid of citizens who are of pensionable age and therefore regarded by society's accountants as a burden. In Holland, one eminent doctor has claimed that the elderly are not admitted to hospitals and certainly not to intensive care units. The Netherlands does not hospitalise the weak, he said, and the elderly in order to make room for young people. Don't believe me? A survey of 6,600 patients in the Netherlands found that treatment, including drugs, food and water, were most likely to be withheld from the over-65s. and in 56% of cases, doctors didn't bother to discuss their failure to treat with their patients or the patient's relatives. I've also seen claims that the elderly are routine killed in Germany, France, Italy and Spain. Age has become a criterion for triage. Genocide is coming to a town near you, if it isn't already there. Back in 2015, when doctors in America were reported to be withholding treatment from elderly patients, doctors said it wasn't ageism. They didn't say what it was, though. It certainly wasn't stamp collecting, and it wasn't kindness or proper, decent medical practice. Michael Bloomberg, the billionaire who nearly became the Democratic presidential candidate in 2020, said America should deny health care to the elderly. There was no suggestion that the morality of it be discussed. In Canada, patients have been buried without post-mortems, and as elsewhere, they were said to have died of the coronavirus if they were thought to have had the bug. Presumably, if a patient with a knife sticking out of their chest had sneezed within 14 days of their death, then they died of coronavirus. This isn't entirely new, of course. In the UK, it was back in February 2005 that it was revealed that the British government had advised that hospital patients with little hope of recovery should be allowed to die because of the cost of keeping them alive. The key words were little hope of recovery. Those words that don't mean anything. Any doctor worthy of the name will tell you that they've seen patients get better despite there being little hope of recovery. But Tony Blair's Labour government suggested that old people be denied the right to food and water if they fell into a coma or couldn't speak for themselves. We shouldn't be surprised, I suppose. The utterly loathsome Blair is, after all, now one of the world's richest war criminals. I don't believe in capital punishment, but we should bring back the death penalty just for him. So, patients should be killed if they couldn't speak for themselves. So much for any hope for stroke victims. Blair's government suggested that the need to cut costs came before the need to preserve the right lives of patients and decided it had the right to overturn a right-to-life ruling which had been made when a judge ordered that artificial nutrition and hydration should not be withdrawn unless the life of a patient could be described as intolerable. The judge had added that when there was any doubt, preservation of life should take precedence. But depriving the elderly of food and water is done all the time. Drinks or food are put on a tray, and if the patient is too ill or weak to reach them, then they're taken away untouched. In most hospitals, no one bothers to feed patients who can't feed themselves. Meanwhile, the government pours money into vanity projects and wastes money on foreign aid programs, which result in crooked politicians putting billions into Swiss bank accounts. And they merrily subsidise the lives of the lazy and the work-shy to buy their votes. Healthy 30-year-olds sit around growing chip backsides and beer bellies, slumped in front of their high-definition digital television sets and opening the windows to let the heat out, because it's easier than turning down the central heating. But the elderly are classified as the unwanted generation. Anyone of pensionable age is a political embarrassment to be ignored or dumped or killed. Elderly individuals facing blindness from age-related macular disease are denied drugs that might have prevented their blindness because they're considered useless and expendable. The theory is that they don't contribute and rarely vote and can therefore be disregarded. How have we managed to forget that in the 1930s the Nazis deliberately starved and dehydrated elderly and vulnerable patients because they were regarded as a useless burden on society?
So there's Dr. Vernon Coleman, who's got a very particularly black sense of humour, Martin. I'm not sure if it's your sense of humour, but he is really sort of doing a kind of, I suppose, sit-down, stand-up comedy in his armchair every day now to do with the pandemic. And one of the things he talks about quite a lot there, but I mean, it's difficult to believe, isn't it, that any healthcare system could actually be designed to kill people. It's supposed to be there to keep you alive. But we've seen, haven't we, with the pharmaceutical industry, never mind the hospitals and that sort of thing, that it can actually make more money if you get people dependent on a drug than if you actually cure them.
Well, that's certainly true. And, of course, some of the things he's saying about trying to save money by getting rid of elderly people, I think there's a lot in that. Although when he says they don't vote, they vote far more than younger people. So, in actual fact, in many ways, a lot of policies are pursued are in the interests of elderly homeowners rather than, for example, gig workers who are never going to get on the property ladder.
He was having a go at he was saying, we should slash foreign aid because it's a waste of money.
Mm.
And he got his wish, didn't he, this week, because foreign aid bills slashed by £3 billion for this year. And number 10 is going to be pulling funding from China. I just think this is fascinating, the way this has worked over the years. This money is used for things like the British Council, which are called kind of, I think, isn't it, white propaganda or soft propaganda?
Mm.
The idea is it's paying for British influence abroad. And whilst the government is taking away £3 billion from this, there are all sorts of other civil society organisations, least of which is the Open Society Project of George Soros, who are actually taking over in a way where this money is left off. So they're buying influence in civil society in these countries where the foreign aid budget is being slashed. It's almost as if there's a kind of private network taking over where these foreign policy decisions and foreign policy spending is being withdrawn.
Yeah, I mean, there's a book called Foreign Aid Reconsidered, and I think it's by Curry. I read it in the 1990s when I was working for CAFOD. And of course, the case for foreign aid is quite complex. And of course, in the Cold War, during the Korean War, for example, and subsequently, British foreign aid served two major purposes. One, as you say, to bolster British soft power. Also, to give markets to British companies. Yeah, you can have some foreign aid as long as you buy our stuff. So the Tanzanians, for example, were inveigled into buying
Foreign Aid Reconsidered is by Roger Riddell.
Oh, Riddell. Okay, I've forgotten the name. Yeah, but anyway, that's an academic study of foreign aid and why countries make foreign aid and so on. If anybody's interested.
Well, why do they?
Well, I'm just coming to that. Okay. During the Cold War, British foreign aid, like US foreign aid, was basically because the Chinese and the Russians were going around all over the developing world saying, we will give you some money in order to defeat the imperialists. And of course, the West and the Americans could have said, well, we're not going to give you any money, we're just going to rip you off. But of course, if they'd done that, they'd have lost the Cold War. But they didn't lose the Cold War. And now, of course, what's going on now is the National Endowment for Democracy is going around all over the world funding political parties which are in favour of US policy and interfering in other people's elections. And that's what foreign aid is all about. In Mozambique, when Frelimo came to power, they banned all outside foreign aid, apart from NGOs that they knew and trusted. And basically, in the developing world, Western aid is regarded as a Trojan horse for Western companies and influence, and the more radical places won't touch it with a barge pole.
So, today is Mask Day. That is to say, midnight last night, every shop that you go into, and probably other places, I think it's railway stations and things like that too, you have to wear a mask, which to me seems bizarre, Martin, since we're just about coming out of the pandemic. So certainly the death numbers are nothing like what they were at the height. And also, even though the lockdown has been being released, there hasn't been a second spike, certainly so far. So why is it that something like this, a massive decision, which we've seen in authoritarian China in the past, but never here, why is it happening just as the virus seems to be disappearing?
Well, you better ask Matt Hancock and the government. But I think, what they're hoping is, we probably don't share views on this, Tony. But I think the fact is that if we were going to wear masks, surely we should have been told from the beginning to wear them. and then it's nice and clear and everybody knows what's going on.
Maybe there weren't enough masks.
Well, I think that's the argument that they made. And of course, there weren't enough masks because they hadn't bothered to replace they were saving money and they didn't bother to replace the old masks that they had in storage.
Now, the massively, massively expensive masks are available in your supermarkets, folks. 10 times what they would have been before the pandemic. But anyway, maybe someone's making a few bob out of this. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Henry Widdus. He's a reporter up in Blackburn, works on local papers up there. And he very spiritingly went out this morning in order to try out some of the supermarkets to see, because he's asthmatic, he doesn't want to wear a mask and he refuses to wear a mask, but he wanted to see how he'd get on going in to do some shopping in 4 different supermarkets with no mask on.
Today is Friday the 24th of July, the first day of mandatory wearing masks in shops. I've got asthma, so I'm going to be trying to go into the Co-op, local Aldi and a spa, all in Blackburn, just see what sort of reaction I get. I've been told my doctor won't give me a note to say that I've got an exemption for having asthma because I don't feel comfortable wearing a mask. I was told to go to Public Health England. From there, I was told to go on the website and see what the exemption information is, and I was not able to find anything useful at all. So I went on the asthma.org website, and they have their own exemption pass, if you like, that you can print out. I don't have a printer, so I've downloaded one as a PDF on my phone. But apparently shops have been given guidance, all the main shops, that they're not to confront shoppers not wearing a mask. So we'll see how it goes.
Just on my first stop at the spa in Mill Hill in Blackburn, really friendly from staff. I did feel like I was being stared at when I walked in. So I just said, oh, I've got asthma. And they said, oh, fine, fine, just go in. And then I spoke to another member of staff who I'd spoken to previously before the regulations came in. And she said, yeah, you should really get a doctor's note. So I told her there was no doctor's note that I could get because the NHS has been told not to give out exemption notes. She said, well, I don't know what we could do if, you know, if a police officer comes in and chooses to fine you, then that's nothing to do with us. So I explained that, you know, I had the exemption note as a PDF. And then when I was at the till, I asked, has anyone else been coming in with no masks on? And they said the occasional one, and that they're not asking for proof of exemption, and, you know, they thought it was fine. So overall, a friendly, positive experience, didn't get any evils from anyone at all. So let's try Co-op next, actually. All right, again, just been to the Co-op, another positive experience. I did get what could have been the evils from a customer walking out when I was walking in who was wearing a mask. But, of course, you can't really tell when their face is covered, but their eyes look like they may have been giving me daggers, but I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. I said, yeah, I've got asthma. Is it okay if I come in? And the member of staff was really friendly. He said, of course you can. People have medical conditions. Just come in any time. You know, we're not going to challenge you at all. And I asked if any other stores are challenging, and she said she thought the Tesco was actually refusing entry to people. There's a Tesco Metro just up the road, so I'm going to try there next, actually. But yeah, overall, a positive experience. I've just been to Tesco, got served fine. It was quite busy in there, Tesco Metro on Livesey Branch Road in Blackburn. I was the only one not wearing a mask. I did get served no problem, although the person on the till wasn't exactly friendly. I was saying, you know, do I need to show anything? He said, well, if you come again next time, you just bring proof of your exemption, or you might have to show a manager a lanyard. So, yeah, it doesn't seem like it's been applied, you know, in terms of the shopkeepers at all. And at the Co-op, they did say, the member of staff said they'd had official guidance not to confront staff not wearing a mask. So all in all, a positive experience so far. I'm just going to try Aldi last. Just been to Aldi, another positive experience. A member of staff said, yeah, it's fine. Yeah, we're not going to challenge you. If someone does ask, just say that you've got asthma. The man at the till wasn't wearing a mask this time. I'd previously spoken to him when he was, and he'd seemed distressed, but they've now got guidance that they don't need to wear masks if they're in the storeroom or on the tills, but they do if they're on the shop floor. Literally everyone in there was wearing a mask. I must have seen about 50 shoppers in there. I was the only one who wasn't wearing one, but no one gave me the evils or anything, I don't think. And, you know, I felt comfortable in there not wearing a mask. So all in all, the 4 shops I've visited have been a positive experience. I had been very worried about going in, that there might have been confrontations from shoppers, and, you know, there's a vibe that you sort of pick up in the mainstream media, especially that, you know, we should all be wearing our masks and doing our civic duty, seems to be very imbalanced. So I'm very pleased that I had no issues at all going into four major sort of chains to do my food shopping. Right, then, my observations for the July the 24th.
So that's Henry Widdus there, who's been on this programme a couple of times in the past, Martin. But of course, today is the first day. Things might tighten up, mightn't they, over the next week or so?
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens, won't it? When I went to the shop this morning, I did wear a mask. I've been going into that shop every day virtually since the beginning of lockdown. And I imagine if I'd gone out, there were people in there who weren't. I decided I would. And I forgot to bring it out with me now, so if I have to go to the shop later, I certainly won't have one with me.
What would you do in that situation? Would you try and go in without one?
Well, I think, we're all over the place now, aren't we? The messaging has become completely confused. Nobody's sure what they're supposed to be doing. And, you know, basically, when there is an inquiry into this, as there must be, we're going to see Britain's response, or rather the government's response from the get-go, has been completely confused.
Well, we heard from the Police Federation, Metropolitan Police Federation chair, I think it's Ken Marsh, last week. He's saying that it hasn't been thought through at all, and that the policing of this is absurd. I mean, I think you might even find police refusing to fine people, even if they're called to a shop, because they've got more important things to do.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, and, you know, the police have also approached they've got to be realistic about what people will and won't do. I mean, like the big rave that was in between Bath and Bristol last weekend, which had loads of people complaining. It was so noisy that people could hear it in Bath and hear it in Kingswood. And there were 5,000 people there. And the police basically let them do it because they couldn't, the alternative of, you know, baton charging 5,000 young people, in the middle of an epidemic, if that's what we're worried about, was no alternative. And ultimately the police make operational decisions and, you know, they're realistic about what's achievable. And I think the only reason why we're being told to wear masks now is because there's pressure from business to get the economy moving, get people back into the shops, et cetera, et cetera. So they're trying to have it both ways, encouraging people to go out and do stuff, but you've got to wear a mask while you do it. And it's basically because they basically don't know what they're doing. From the very beginning, they've stumbled around, blundering into one crisis after another. And if you compare what we've done with the successful countries, we have been pretty, pretty lackadaisical in every level.
But I keep pointing this out every week, Martin, that it looks to me, I'm not sure if it looks like it to you, that particularly Britain, even more than the US, had this virus circulating well before it was even supposed to exist.
Well, I think these are questions that need to be discussed. Does it come from a biowarfare lab in Wuhan or elsewhere? Is it genuinely natural? And of course, the Pompeo and others are saying, no, it came from a Chinese biowarfare lab and they did it deliberately. Now, of course, we know that the anthrax attacks after 9/11 came from Fort Detrick. And we also know that Fort Detrick in Maryland was looking into coronavirus from bats because they were doing joint studies with people in Wuhan. Now, it can't be a pandemic made of nothing and there isn't any real virus and at the same time a bioweapon. I'm inclined to think that it is a bioweapon. And that's why, and in the communist countries like Vietnam, Kerala in southern India, where the communists have been in power since the 1940s, Bulgaria, because it used to be a communist country, they carried out a full biowarfare agency lockdown, and they have basically done very, very well. Whereas in this country, we ignored it until it was too late, which is why we've got thousands of excess deaths.
I mean, you mentioned the Charmy Down party on Saturday night, which obviously did keep some people awake in the local area. Although, I mean, I've been to festivals where there's lots and lots of noise and loads of music going on in very early hours, and you manage to get to sleep. You just kind of, I always find, the best thing to do is to, if you listen to it and you're listening to it and then actually you drop off. You know, there is a whole thing of, well, if you're not used to having music nearby, and you're living in the countryside and it's normally very quiet, you know, that they may just sort of, well, I can't sleep and get up and go and try and find out what's going on, etc. But, I think it's fair to say this is one of the biggest protests against the lockdown that's taken place. I mean, they've completely ignored
it. It's hardly a protest. They just wanted to have a rave, didn't they?
Well, I know, but it's saying, look, never mind about all the social distancing rules. We're just going to do this anyway. And to be fair to them, they did have facilities for people who needed welfare help and first aid and that sort of thing actually on site there.
Yeah. I mean, and don't forget, all the pubs and nightclubs are closed. And if you're in your early 20s or late teens and you want to get out there and find somebody from the opposite sex or even the same sex, and the summer's going by, you're quite keen to get out there and do something, aren't you? And it's going to be the police are in an impossible position. And, you know, we will see what comes out of all of this in the longer term. And that means towards the end of the year, we'll have a better idea of whether anything that's been done has been successful.
Well, the BBC say 3,000. I've seen other reports saying 5,000 people attended this rave at Charmy Down. In London, I'm afraid, they only manage hundreds gathering in Hyde Park in the daytime, not just in the night, to protest against wearing masks.
That was a protest. A rave, effectively, is people having fun, and they're ignoring the rules. But then ravers generally ignore rules anyway. They're taking illegal drugs for a start off, most of them.
And they're actually on private property, which they're supposed to apply for licenses and all sorts of things. The thing is, we've gone into a stage now, haven't you, where you, to set up a sound system in a field and have a dance is now, you've got to get a license to do it. And of course now they're going to say no. So we've seen a complete change in the last 30 or 40 years in this country, from free festivals with thousands of people attending them to now you've got to have a license to do anything.
Yeah, and there's always been tension about it. When the rave scene started getting going in the late 80s, it was all illegal raves.
And the police used the license to close down the Big Green Gathering as well, and bankrupt it.
Yeah, so in other words, you could argue that people who had basically pushed for their own, I mean, what eventually happened is the super clubs like Cream in Liverpool and Ministry of Sound and so on took over that niche of the market, much safer in many ways. Because, of course, you know, and I used to go to raves back in that era, and you could be getting into a factory or something like that, where you'd be having the rave, or a warehouse. And basically there's no toilet facilities. You know, you could easily get, if there was a fire, you'd be in real trouble. And, you know, you can't just say, well, let just people do what they want. There are health and safety concerns, especially when people are taking potentially dangerous drugs, which they do at these events.
Well, like I say, they have people on hand to help people like that. They have a whole welfare
some are well organised and some are not. Some are not well organised. I mean, there's been some badly organised ones, which of course, I mean,
do you believe in people's right to party?
I'm absolutely in favour of it, but I also don't believe in unnecessarily endangering people and causing annoyance to third parties.
A lot of this goes back to 1993, wasn't it? The Criminal Justice Act. That, I think, was one of the particular times in history where these illegal raves, or were basically what was happening all over the country, raves, were made illegal. And it's nice to see anyway, I think. I'm very proud as a Bristolian to see that's still being protested against.
Well, I mean, they were always illegal. There was no need for the Criminal Justice Act at all. I mean, it just provoked laughter when they said that people are playing music with repetitive beats. It's actually in the law that you can't play music with repetitive beats. That just led to shrieks.
So you're allowed to have one beat? Yes. Is that the idea?
I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all. And of course, you know, if you're on private property and all the rest of it, it's very difficult for the police to stop, but it's illegal in any case.
Anyway, at least there was no mask rubbish lying across the field afterwards, because they weren't wearing any masks like we are, most of us are supposed to be doing now. But anyway, let's go to Prime Minister's questions this week, where this whole idea of the face covering, or... See, this is the other thing, isn't it? The word face covering rather than mask. Mask sounds a bit too much like muzzle. That came up at Prime Minister's questions this week.
Ben Lake... Speaker, face coverings will become mandatory on public transport in Wales next Monday. Now, a zero VAT rating has been applied to most PPE since the 1st of May, but at present it does not apply to non-medical face coverings. Will the Prime Minister therefore extend the zero rating to these items so that members of the public, especially those on low incomes, are not financially penalised for following the rules?
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Speaker, as the honourable gentleman knows, and I thank him very much for his question, we have removed VAT from all PPE, including VAT on face masks that, as everybody knows, can protect from infection, and that removed the burden of VAT in care homes, NH trusts, and for key workers. For homemade face masks, those which meet the PHE guidance will be covered and will continue to be covered by the zero rate, but I'm happy to ask the relevant minister to write to him to clarify the entire position.
Friday is the first anniversary of my right honourable friend becoming Prime Minister.
Oh, so that is Boris's anniversary today. But the main point they're making there, Martin, is it's okay to have this no VAT on professional masks, but for the rest of us, we're going to have to pay VAT on these.
Well, it's an issue, isn't it? I mean, the mask that I've got at home that I forgot to bring out was given to me on the protest when Colston's statue went down, because some public-spirited young lady had spent all night making hundreds of them and giving them all to the protesters, and that's where I got mine from.
So are you allowed to just sort of pull your T-shirt up over your nose? Does that count?
Well, as you know, we heard earlier from what's going on in Blackburn, I think some people are going to wear them, some people aren't, and there's not really much point getting angry about it.
Well, one person who is smouldering about masks is Dr. Vernon Coleman. We're going to hear more from him this week. I think you can only call him a sit-down comedian. It's a little bit like a better version of the Ronnie Corbett show, because his long stories didn't really seem to go anywhere and they weren't very funny. But Vernon Coleman's made, I think, an excellent job of this week. He classes mask wearers as collaborators.
And so on the 24th of July, we have to start dressing up as bank robbers whenever we go shopping. The shop assistants don't have to wear masks, but the shoppers do. Apparently, according to Boris the buffoon, the coronavirus can't jump to or from a shop assistant, but can jump to or from a shopper. How clever the coronavirus is to know how to do this. Of course, if a shop assistant pops into a neighbourhood shop, then they have to put a mask on, because then they become a customer, and when they're a customer, they can catch the virus and spread it. Another oddity is that although the coronavirus can infect shoppers, it can't affect people who work in offices. It seems that this very intelligent virus just seems to say to itself, I can infect these people because they're just out shopping, but I mustn't infect these people because they're working. If all this sounds like unscientific gibberish, that's probably because it's totally unscientific gibberish. And how clever, too, for the authorities to know that people in shops must wear masks, but not give their names and addresses, whereas people in pubs must give their names and addresses, but not wear masks. If we weren't fighting a war against the most evil cabal ever put together in the history of mankind, then it would be laughable. And look at the history behind this latest change of heart. Professor Jonathan Van Tam, Deputy Chief Medical Officer, previously announced that there was no need to wear a mask. And Michael Gove, a weedy little British politician who's about as far removed from being a statesman as Bill Gates is from being a doctor, said that the UK government didn't plan to insist that we all wore masks in shops. I bet he feels an idiot now. Because within hours, Boris Johnson, our Führer, backed up by laws which would have been envied by Stalin, Hitler and Attila the Hun, not to mention Vlad the Impaler and Genghis Khan, suddenly decided, seemingly all by himself, that the entire nation should wear masks whenever they ventured into a shop. Everyone knows the disease has almost died out. It'll soon be less of a threat than athlete's foot. If the coronavirus were a pop record, it would be about to slip out of the top 100 and slide into oblivion. Anyone who wears a mask is a spineless and moronic collaborator, helping the worst people this world has ever seen. Independent research by a bunch of florists, mark you, not people who look at crop diseases, has shown that mask wearers aren't capable of thinking for themselves. They're not very bright, they're followers, the sort of people who, as children, dreamt of being concentration camp guards. They never do anything or achieve anything. They are saddos, nerds and remainers, invariably devoted to the European Union. Put on a mask and you're bending a knee before Gates, Soros, the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers, Blair and the Clintons. One evil, soulless bunch. I've recorded two videos about Gates, by the way. Please watch them if you haven't. The first video is called Just a Little Prick, Part 1. And with startling originality that I'm very proud of, the second video is called Just a Little Prick, Part 2. The mass media invariably describe Bill Gates as a philanthropist, the BBC and The Guardian, both sharing some of the Gates wealth, probably think he should be known as Saint Bill. However, I'm going to try and get the Oxford Dictionary to revise its definition of the word philanthropist. It should read, a philanthropist is an evil crook who has absolutely no interest in the welfare of others, but who uses large donations of money to buy power and control and to make even more money. I'll suggest that synonyms of philanthropist should include slimy single-cell organism usually found at the bottom of filthy ponds. Just remember all that next time you see anyone describing themselves or being described as a philanthropist. The idiots wandering around in their little masks are bending the knee to the toxic Gates. In my view, a being so dangerous and diseased that he should be rammed into a test tube and kept in Madame Tussaud's Chamber of Horrors. Mothers could take their children and point him out as the definition of evil, and they're bending a knee to more candidates for the Chamber of Horrors. Blair, the hideous Clintons, the foul Obama and the rest of the malignant crew. Oh, and the wretched Boris Johnson, too. The mindless mask wearers are collaborators, and when war ends, you know what happens to collaborators. Most of them are political innocents who voted Remain because they didn't bother to do enough research to know that the EU had been set up by Nazis to enable post-war Germany to control Europe. Finally, I'll leave you with my new mantra. No silly mask, no deadly vaccine, no social distancing. Please learn it, recite it, and share it with the collaborators who seem determined to drag us down with them, but who will fail, because those of you who have seen the light have a monopoly on wisdom, courage and integrity. Two other small things. First, the channel is growing so fast that YouTube doesn't always manage to send out notifications about new videos. I'm sure this is just a technical hitch. We try to research, write, edit, record and put out a new one each day at 7 p.m. though this doesn't leave much time for sleeping and eating, and virtually none for dealing with emails. Second, as you know, we don't accept ads or sponsors or any money for the channel or the website, and I promise that we never will. However big the channel gets or the website gets, there'll never be any outside money involved. Unlike the BBC, for example, which sold out years ago and can't be trusted to tell the time, this is a genuine non-commercial public service channel. We specialise in the truth, served with a little spice, I hope, and leave bias, prejudice and fake news to the vastly overpaid cretins at the BBC. Thank you for watching An Old Man in a Chair, and thank you for all your support and encouragement. Please copy and share the videos on Twitter and Facebook and BitChute. If you'd like to put on a translation, that would be great. If the videos disappear, then please go to my website, www.vernoncolman.com, to find out where you might be able to find them, or at least to read the transcripts. The transcripts of the banned videos are on the website too. Although it may seem like it at times, please remember that you're not on your own. More and more people are waking up, and I firmly believe that together we will win this fight. If you go to mainstream media, please put on a note asking people to come and look at these videos. Thank you for watching.
So that's A Man in a Chair, Vernon Coleman, Dr. Vernon Coleman. Martin, I saw you smiling at some of the comments, but harumphing at others.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a bit of, I mean, that's a very, very long rant. And if I was in the pub and somebody came up to me and started ranting me like that, I think my eyes would glaze over and I'd perhaps go to the other bar. He's entitled to his views.
How do you think he does in trying to actually inject a bit of comedy into this?
Well, I think the comedy is not... When he goes on about how Boris is Hitler, which is basically what he's saying, I think that basically exaggerates Boris and underestimates Hitler.
Well, he's saying he's a buffoon. Basically, he was putting on an act as being a buffoon, and actually he is a buffoon.
No, well, I totally agree with that. And, of course, people are entitled to their views. But I think the idea that it's all a vast conspiracy by the EU to make us wear masks. It sounds to me...
He didn't say that, did he? Well, he's pointing the finger at Bill Gates, and yes, so am I.
Well, know. Yes, but I mean, the problem is, I'm perfectly willing to criticise Bill Gates, and whether it's... there was no discussion there of bio-warfare, for example. Nothing in there at all.
Well, you'll probably find there is on some of his videos. Yes, that one was just about masks.
All right, well, anyway, I believe in freedom of speech. He can say whatever he likes, and I can have my own views about all of these things, and I've got a different take on it from him. That's all I'll say.
Okay, so one other thing on COVID-19. A letter in Newcastle paper. This is a prisoner of COVID-19. I'm in my 90s and a resident in a care home. I've been in lockdown for 16 weeks. Tested each month, I've been declared COVID-19 negative and fit. I use an exercise bike daily and take other exercise, yet I am still caged up like a wild animal to meet the government edicts. Watching the rest of the world go about their daily business, even going abroad on holiday, I now know what it's like to be in prison. The doors are controlled by an electronic code, so there's no way I can escape. And that's written by name and address supplied in the letters column of a Newcastle paper. Or maybe even actually a national paper.
Well, as I understand it, those who have been told to shelter themselves, that is about to be lifted, and they're about to be allowed out, and people are allowed to be allowed in. And
people are not going to be allowed into care homes at all. The only staff, and if you're doing visits in care homes, you will have to be out in the garden, so it's going to be a garden visit, okay. And anyway, only one person at a time, and no coming within 2 metres of your loved one.
All right. Well, I, as I say, the way in which the British state has approached all of this has been absolutely execrable from the beginning. We are now mopping up and trying to solve further problems which began. Oh,
but hang on, because Alison Pollock, and we reported her on this show, she called it, she's a public health expert from Newcastle University, yep. Called it barbaric.
What barbaric?
The idea that you can't hug your loved ones, all this sort of thing, when nobody's actually ill.
Oh, how can you say nobody's actually ill, Tony?
Well, if you've got an elderly patient and a young relative, neither of whom are showing any symptoms of COVID-19, and to say that they can't touch each other is barbaric. That's what she's saying.
Okay, well, listen.
And also that you can't go to funerals and this sort of thing.
Yeah, there's loads of downsides to all of this, and everybody's entitled to their views, as I say. But I think it's very fascinating that Chinese Communist Party, the Vietnamese Communist Party, and the Communist Party that ran Kerala in India, they have got a total of less than 5,000 dead in the whole of their countries. And don't forget, about, you know, one quarter of humanity lives in China.
Do we trust these figures?
I trust
them. Do we trust our own figures?
No, we don't. I don't trust our own figures. I don't trust our own government as far as I could spit.
You do trust Chinese and Vietnam's figures?
Yes, I do. Because Why? They've treated it as a biological warfare attack, which is probably what it is. And it was a biological warfare attack which was designed to bring down the economy of China, and also to bring to allow bailing out of the banking system in 2008.
So if you treat it as a biological warfare attack, your figures can be trusted?
Well, in New Zealand, which is not a communist country, they've had 27 deaths.
But Martin, we keep repeating this little discussion, you and I. Mm. The New Zealanders had no cases when we had possibly millions of cases,
yes.
And they could prevent the virus, we couldn't.
Yes, and we locked down in my school where I was working on the same day that the Northern Ireland decided to close the schools, because the Republic of Ireland had decided to close the schools, then Scotland closed the schools, and then Boris decided to close our school a week later. Now, that means we're a week late into lockdown. That week is crucial. And when we do an inquiry, and there will be an inquiry, it will be seen that that week was a crucial week.
At that inquiry, what will probably be said is that we were 3 months late in lockdown, not 1 week late.
Yes, yes. In actual fact, we should have locked down a lot earlier. And, of course, the Israeli Defense Forces were told in November last year that a pandemic was coming out of China. That's according to the Times of Israel and ABC News. Now, that means that the Defense Intelligence Agency in the US knew there was going to be a pandemic in November last year. I asked people to consider, what does that suggest about where this pandemic came from?
Did they know it, or were they just suspecting?
They told the IDF, the Israelis were told, there's going to be a pandemic coming out of China in November. And that people can check this, it's in the Times of Israel.
Well, let's finish the first hour on, well, it's a bit longer than an hour, isn't it? More like 2 hours. But let's finish on some good news, and that is that the coronavirus financial black hole facing Bristol City Council has shrunk. A series of recent announcements from Westminster has eased pressure on City Hall. So the Bristol Mayor, Labour Mayor, allegedly Marvin Rees, has said that we need a lot of help, and now he's getting it. The deficit or the black hole has shrunk from 86 million now to only 17.7 million in a couple of weeks. The government is actually now starting to realise it needs to be dishing out money to local authorities, Martin.
Well, insofar as that's happening, it's welcome, but I doubt very much whether they are going to be able to deal with all the knock-on effects, you know, without a comprehensive plan to reboot the economy, which is pretty much what was in the Labour manifesto, in fact.
So that's 70 million the government have given Bristol City Council after the mayor's made a fuss about it.
Yeah, well, I mean, ultimately, if they don't bail out local government, especially in inner city areas, it's going to collapse. And there may be four years of Tory government, but a complete meltdown in the inner cities, which could easily happen this summer. You can easily see that young people, if they get arrested for whatever reason, they're all going to be out on the streets. The possibility of rioting like in 2011 or 1981 is definitely there. And that, of course, then leads to knock-on effects on the economy, effects on the pound, and so on.
OK, so let's finish on the rave that you mentioned. 3,000, 5,000, no-one's quite sure how many people were there at Charmy Down on Saturday night, right the way into Sunday. The police decided they couldn't shut it down. And in fact, the BBC on Sunday, their headline read, obviously written by some probably a younger journalist, as almost all the BBC online journalists seem to be very young, and very few of the older journalists seem to be still around, had said something, I can't remember the exact headline, but it was saying that the police couldn't stop it. By Monday morning, when the main editor came in, he changed that to illegal rave at RAF site. So he got rid of the thing in the headline about the police not being able to stop the rave. And I thought it would be nice to pay tribute to a certain extent to the ravers by playing a rave tune I can remember from the 1990s. So this, I think, is 1992.
One who forgot to reset it. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable.
So that from 1992 is X-Sight, The Light, They're Here Dance Mix, one of the tunes I can remember enjoying in the 1990s. But so, welcome back to the BCFM online-only politics show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Well, US fighters are buzzing, that is, aircraft buzzing in an Iranian airliner over Syria. What are these illegal US jets doing there? And they cause it injuries on board the airliner because it had to take evasive action. Also, China must retaliate, to quote somebody, we'll see who in a minute, after the US closes the Houston consulate. And apparently there was somebody hiding in the consulate who thought that they were going to be arrested, a Chinese person. So the US has decided they're going to close the consulate instead. So I imagine they were using that as an excuse to arrest this person and put them on trial, whoever they are. And Pompeo says the US will no longer tolerate China. What is he talking about? How can he say we're no longer going to tolerate China? Also today, Goldman Sachs has paid $4 billion as a fine in compensation over the 1MDB scandal in Singapore, as their state wrestles back control from the international Bilderberg banksters. Also, was lingerie chain Victoria's Secret's owner Les Wexner the Epstein and Maxwell money man? That's what one of Maxwell and Epstein's cool girls, Maria Farmer, believes in conversation with Chile-based US journalist Whitney Webb. And finally, what was really poisoned in Salisbury? The Skripals or US-Russia relations? Those bungling Russians in Salisbury and the Skripal affair were the reason Theresa May's government passed the UK version of the 2012 US Magnitsky Act. That happened in May 2018, and it's just been used to put 49 Russians on the list. This allows UK authorities to name any person at any time with no appeal and no question as human rights abusers or money launderers. Wherever they are in the world, their UK assets are then frozen and their visas rescinded. So first tonight, why the Salisbury story can't possibly be true. The pandemic also to cover the bailout. His website is Alex Craner, is the guy we'll be talking to, is Third Alliance, T-H-I-R-D, thirdalliance.ch. His book, The Grand Deception, The Truth About Bill Browder, The Magnitsky Act and Anti-Russia Sanctions. So I think we should start, Martin, with this horrendous attack, really, on an Iranian airliner by US fighters. What, first of all, what are these US fighters doing flying around over Syria? Surely the Russians or the Syrians should just shoot them down.
Well, they could, but that would then escalate the situation. So they've basically ignored them.
Are they based in Syria? Where are they flying?
They're probably in Jordan. From? They're probably based in Jordan.
Flying in from a foreign country? Surely when they cross the border, they should just be shot down, shouldn't they?
Well, if the Syrians did shoot them down, they would be within their rights. But they've chosen
why don't they?
Because they're trying to avoid a war, unlike the Americans, who are trying to create a war. The purpose of this...
We would not be allowing Russian jets, for example, to fly around over Britain, would we?
No, we wouldn't.
And if they decided they were going to do that, would we shoot them down? I think
we would. We probably would, yeah.
So what's the difference between us and the Syrians?
The Syrians have had a nine-year onslaught directed by Western intelligence services, the Saudi Mukhabarat, and various jihadi groups, which in fact we fund and direct. And they've been fighting. They've taken tens of thousands of casualties in the Syrian army. But do you know what? They've won, because it's their country and we're not going to tell
them what to do. Well, the Americans, in the form of CENTCOM, and I think they are one of these, aren't they based in Stuttgart in Germany? I think they might be.
Yeah.
These are the American commands of the whole world. Now, you know, you hear stories of people wanting to take over the world. Well, the Pentagon did that when it created this unified command structure. And CENTCOM is the one for the Middle Eastern region. They confirmed the incident, saying that they intercepted the airliner in accordance with international standards to ensure the safety of US ground troops at the Al Tanf base inside Syria. They confirmed that it was identified as a Maha Air flight, but did not specify any specific contact. The US has blacklisted Maha Air, accusing them of smuggling arms. So effectively, that's what these US jets were doing, Martin. But apparently, this was just an airliner. There may have been arms on there. We don't know. But the abrupt change of course that the airliner had to do when these fighters flew right next to it, that several people were injured as the abrupt change in course. The plane then landed at Beirut and after a stop-off returned back to Tehran without incident.
Well, the Al-Tanf base is illegal. There's no basis for it in international law.
But the Americans are there sending these jets up to protect it, apparently.
Yeah, but they shouldn't be there at all. There's actually a refugee camp not far away. The refugees actually want to leave the camp and go to Syrian government control, but the Americans won't let them, and they won't let anybody else in there to find out what's going on. Don't forget, there have been all sorts of attacks on infrastructure inside Iran. We were talking about Russian cyber attacks on British infrastructure. Well, the Israelis and the Americans have been carrying out cyber attacks on Iranian infrastructure in the last week. And the war faction in Israel wants to see a war with Iran before the November election because they're a bit worried that Biden won't be as biddable as Trump. And of course, if there is a war with Iran, Boris Johnson will jump in with both feet. And of course, it's nothing that we're talking about. But if it happens, there will be all sorts of consequences. And probably worrying about COVID and Brexit will be the least of our worries. But that's the dangerous world we live in and the kind of reckless people who are in charge of it. And I would regard the British government as a bit like a teenage girl who's got into a stolen car with their boyfriend and wants to get out now, but he ain't stopping. And the police are at the whole thing is turning into a nightmare. And that's probably what will happen if the war faction in Israel gets its way. And of course, they get lots of encouragement from the war faction in the US and others in the deep state here.
Okay, another story. China has got to retaliate after the US closes its consulate in Houston. Understands there's somebody who has broken, or at least the Americans allege, has broken the terms of her visa, had her house raided when she was in and around Houston somewhere, and then she decided rather than just kind of carry on as normal, she would seek some sort of shelter in the Chinese consulate there. The Americans have now decided they're going to close the consulate.
Yeah, I believe the Chinese have closed a similar consulate inside China. Because, of course, you can do that. I mean, these are the preludes to war.
It's the Wuhan one, I think, that they've decided they want to close.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the Wuhan, Wuhan consulate, all of those people were repatriated to the US at the beginning of the COVID crisis. They now want to go back, and the Chinese have been saying you can come back, but we're going to test you all before you can come in, because that's what non-Kutistan countries are doing. They've got rid of the virus and they don't want it coming back. But in any case, this is more to do with diplomatic saber-rattling. And as you mentioned there, Pompeo is saying that the US is no longer going to tolerate China, which seems an extraordinary thing to say, because I don't see how they're going to get rid of China other than a nuclear attack, which is suicidal for the United States.
Even then, it won't get rid of it. There'll still be some Chinese left.
Well, that's what Mao Zedong famously said back in the 1960s. If there's a nuclear war, millions will die, but communism will be successful and capitalism will be defeated. And that's one of his famous quotes.
What does he really mean, though, when he says we will no longer tolerate China? I mean, he's saying they're not going to be part of the international architecture to whatever extent the Americans can enforce that.
Yeah, that's basically what it is.
We don't recognise China as a country.
Yeah, no, what they want to do is overthrow the Chinese communist regime. Now, and since 1972, when Nixon went to talk to Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai, as it then was.
I think it was with Henry Kissinger, wasn't it?
Basically, there's been a gradual, a practical relationship developed between the Chinese government and the West. And, of course, what really worries the deep state in the US is that the Chinese are just getting too good at capitalism. And, very successful companies like Huawei with a lower cost base and a better product than they've got, they can't tolerate. And that's one of the reasons why I suspect there may have been a bio-warfare attack. Because if you don't get the Chinese now, in 5 or 10 years' time, you're not going to be able to catch them. And it's quite clear that Pompeo and the faction he represents in the CIA and others are determined to have a war with China, or at least an ongoing confrontation with China, because any war is likely to be one-sided. If they if there's a fight in the South China Sea, the US aircraft carriers are all going to be sunk. So that's 5,000 chaps on each aircraft carrier. It won't take long until they've got a big casualty list. And of course, the Chinese have got a very, very big army. And if they're defending what they regard as their own territory, they're not going to pull any punches, are they?
Okay, so he's also been in the UK this week, Pompeo, hoping for some big splash with this Intelligence and Security Committee on China. But it looks to me as if he is a bit of a damp squib, and he's turned up and he was hoping for this massive attack on Russia from the British Intelligence and Security Committee, and he didn't really get that, did he?
Yeah, I don't think he came because of that committee. He came because he's basically whipping Boris into line for the coming war on China, as John Pilger's film warned everybody about some years ago. They are basically going to have a confrontation with China. Very dangerous stuff. The Chinese are well able to defend themselves. And of course, one of the other things that the Chinese are doing, they're talking to the Syrian army. There are Chinese army liaison officers working with the Syrian army, not least because there's plenty of Uyghurs inside the Idlib pocket who have been, pushed in there by the Turkish MIT secret services. So, we are on the brink of major confrontations unless common sense prevails.
We are having confrontations. These are confrontations. Yeah. Well, the basic relations between China and the US breaking down, the relations between Britain and Russia breaking down,
yeah,
although it doesn't seem as if they've broken down quite as much as they might have done this week, there seems to be an attempt, and in fact, even with the vaccine, the virus, and all this sort of stuff, there is an enormous divisions being created in society by all this. It does seem as if there's this whole what we call the expression hardening the sides going on, where people are increasingly, like you and I maybe, over the coronavirus, Martin, having to choose their side.
Yeah, I think that,
so you don't have a spread of opinion. You've got one side or the other.
Well, yes, I mean, it's polarisation, isn't it? I think what's beginning to be... I mean, the Chinese and the Russians basically just want to do business with the West. That's all they want. Just recognise that we exist. Let's cooperate together.
The United States is now saying no. Because you've outcompeted us, so we've had enough of you guys.
Yes. And that, of course, as we had that GRU guy, on the show some weeks ago, that's the Russian secret military intelligence saying, well, we think this COVID attack is a bioweapon. It's designed to undermine China, and we're all going to war. Now, he wasn't speaking in an official capacity, but it was from a video. He was wearing a uniform. I'm pretty certain that the Russian and Chinese intelligence services are pretty good, have pretty much worked out what's going on, and they've worked out there's no point talking to the West. They ain't interested.
But they are talking to us, aren't they?
Yeah, they're pretending to carry on talking while they get ready to fight. That's where we're at.
Okay, well, one part of all of this, and we've been talking a lot about potential military warfare and lots about the economic warfare today, and, of course, cyber warfare with the alleged Russian attempts to hack or alter the results of the Brexit vote and other elections here in Britain. Well, yes, me too. I think the whole thing is complete hot air, Martin. But, I mean, on the side of psychological warfare, Richie Allen this week again was talking to Neil Oliver, the well-known TV presenter, historian, about censorship generally. And I thought this was an absolutely fascinating piece here. What Richie is saying, and this would fit in with what you're saying, Martin, about 2020 being potentially, well, the Great Reset, but what is going to cause the Great Reset, Prince Charles's great dream, is potentially a really, catastrophic economic and possibly even a fighting war later on this year. And what Richie has been doing is chatting, he says, to one of his friends who works at Google, is saying that that YouTube and Google, who of course are absolutely dominant in the internet, are now thinking about cutting off loads of free speech later on this year. But anyway, he's chatting here with Neil Oliver, the historian, too. So let's have a listen to Richie Allen this week talking about censorship.
I was listening to talk radio earlier on today, and very interesting little bit of commentary from Neil Oliver. Now, Neil Oliver is an archaeologist and a broadcaster, and he's a very interesting guy, is Neil Oliver. He was on Mike Graham's programme, and Oliver was lamenting how utterly impotent comedy is in 2020, and he was also musing about self-censorship. And the chap, Neil Oliver, is very eloquent. This is stark stuff. Have a listen to what he says.
And people are being terribly careful not to say the wrong word, just to trot out dogma, just to say the things that they think will get them the pass to the, you know, to the rest of their lives and to be able to go about a business unmolested. And there's definitely been a lack of humour. You know, the what passes for comedy on mainstream television at the moment, I would say, is risible in the very worst sense of the word. It's pompous, censorious sermons, sneering at various sections of the society. I don't feel inclined to laugh about it. I've found that I've had to go mining for contraband, you know, on YouTube and other platforms, looking for the humour of the past. You mentioned Billy Connolly.
Yeah.
You know, me, partly probably because of my upbringing and whatever. I revere Connolly as one of the funniest human beings ever to draw breath.
Yeah.
But I've gone back looking for, you know, Bill Hicks, Robin Williams, Chris Rock,
yeah,
because I'm in desperate need of the irreverence. I'm in desperate need of it. It's like taking illicit drugs or something.
Yes.
You know, going back and hearing someone, even just 10 years ago, having the audacity, you know, to say the unsayable, because that's where we are now.
Yeah.
The unsayable is definitely there. Pretty soon you'll be caught out for thinking the unthinkable.
Yes.
Yeah, it's occurring to a lot of people like him. Maybe it wouldn't have occurred to him before COVID. It is dawning on people like him what is happening to their world, to their friends and family, and they don't like it, and they're speaking out about it. Is it too late? I don't know. Let me tell you this very briefly. I put a post on Facebook earlier on today. I've known a couple of guys who've worked for Google. In fact, I know three guys. Two who worked for Google and one guy who left Google and who came on this program to talk with me a year and a half ago about Google's censorship against alternative right platforms. And my two mates who work at Google, both of them still there, they've dropped me one or two bits of information over the years. Nothing groundbreaking, really. Just little bits of information about things that are happening there. And I was in touch with one of them this morning. And he said to me, look, you need to have a heads up on what's been happening around the COVID virus and the COVID vaccine. And he said to me, before a COVID vaccine is ready, it's already been decided by Google, YouTube. Google owns YouTube. That's the dreadful thing in and of itself. I talked about that many, many times on the programme. They have decided that they're going to take down thousands, possibly tens of thousands of channels around about the time that the vaccine is ready to go. And, allegedly, they're going to do this in tandem with Facebook and Twitter, who will do the same thing. Basically, delete hundreds of thousands of groups, maybe, where people are talking about vaccine safety. Now, you can take this with a pinch of salt if you like. Because while I know the guy definitely works for Google, verification of this information is basically impossible. But I believe him. Now, he's not working at management level, so he's not, you know, sitting in on management meetings and listening to this stuff. And I did ask him that, how do you know? And he said, well, this sort of stuff trickles down, Richie. He said, they've made the decision. And what you're seeing in the newspapers and listening to on talk radio about how dangerous anti-vaxxers are, and how much of a threat they represent to everybody's safety, this is all a build-up to this culling of tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, of YouTube channels and accounts. It's happening, Richie. He also said that the claims that much of the 5G information, which they call misinformation, much of the vaccine information, which they call misinformation. The claims that we hear or that we read about in our newspapers, the claims that Russia is behind this stuff, is obviously nonsense. It's obviously nonsense that Russia is behind it. But basically, this is all part of them legislating for mass censorship, getting the public to accept that there's a big threat, you know, that your health and safety is at risk because a foreign agent is spreading this false information online, even though the vast majority of groups on Facebook, at least as far as I've seen, and I'm not on Facebook very often, but I do ask Rog, and Rog tells me he's in several of these groups. The vast majority of these groups are what you would call grassroots groups set up by ordinary people who are concerned. They're not Russia. But it's those groups they want to get rid of on the pretext that it's Russia spreading the misinformation. So if you've got, you know, your own YouTube channel and you've put information on there, you really need to back it up. Anything that you've uploaded, videos that you might want to keep because you might have had an interview with somebody, you might have had a video with some interesting information, you've got to put these things somewhere safe. You've got to download them and put them, make hard copies of them, because this is coming down, according to my mate. And that's all I can say about that. Okay? I asked him about, you know, what do his mates think about it? And he said, there hasn't been much talk about it, maybe because people are very, very nervous working in tech, that if you were to be dismissed from a company labelled as a troublemaker, you might find it difficult then in the future to get a job in the industry with another company. So that's what he's saying to me. He says that he's hearing that the decision has been made in order to try and kind of see off opposition or resistance to a COVID vaccine. They've already decided in the weeks leading up to the vaccine becoming available, there's going to be a mass deletion of channels. People will be difficult to find using the Google search engine. And he reckons discussions have already taken place with Twitter and Facebook to work in tandem doing that. That's what he says, and that's what he said to me. You can take that with a pinch of salt, or you can take it to heart. It's entirely up to you. This is Wednesday's Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford.
Okay, so that's the Richie Allen Show this week, Martin. Well, he's saying it's an insider leak. And it does kind of make sense, doesn't it? A lot of this stuff around the vaccine. I mean, the big take home from that little bit of info from Richie, I mean, we can't verify it. And he's making absolutely clear this is just a conversation he's had with someone. It's not an on the record, it's an off the record conversation. He's keeping them anonymous. Is basically, if you want to understand how safe vaccines are, you need to do that now, because a lot of this material may have disappeared off the internet by the time a COVID-19 vaccine comes along. And of course, that vaccine isn't necessarily going to be anything like the cowpox vaccine. It's potentially going to be an RNA vaccine. So it's going to be completely genetically engineered, or it may even be one of these CRISPR vaccines, which go in to snip your chromosomes. Not a normal vaccine at all. In fact, I don't even think they should be calling them vaccines. But anyway, what do you make of that leak, apparently, that Richie's got there?
Well, I mean, we know that people are trying to control the narrative. And it wouldn't surprise me if preparations have been made of the kind he's suggesting. I still very much doubt that they've got a vaccine.
Well, apparently there's about 50 in the pipeline.
Yeah, but none of them seem to actually work.
So far?
Yeah.
Well, several have been now being trialled on humans.
Yeah, well, it may well be that they'll say they've got a vaccine, which isn't really a vaccine for COVID at all. It's just got another purpose. That's perfectly possible. And then they can then use that on the I mean, they were talking about injecting people with computer chips so that they can, you know, basically be tracked. Now, all of this is possible, but I think the answer to this is, when it comes to it, does it happen? And it's all very well to speculate, and we'll have to see, won't we? I suspect we're going to be dealing not with the problems with vaccination, we're going to be dealing with warfare-based problems and economic collapse
too,
problems.
Yeah, but I mean, obviously, if you put something in your body that's going to disable you rather than help you, then that's a big decision to make. I mean, we've got this whole thing of informed consent, which is the idea of you have a relationship with a doctor, and that specific individual and you have got a relationship over many years, even potentially, and that informed consent is a decision that you make based on the advice of your doctor. Now, we're now moving towards a much more coercion, aren't we? Where, so, for example, a government may say, you've got to have this. Now, they've done this with animals in the past. So, for example, they've had, you know, voluntary and then mandatory treatments that have got to be given to farm animals. Now that seems to be moving to humans, where we may have to have something. Otherwise, say, for example, we don't get our civil liberties.
Well, we shall see what happens when we get there.
That's why I think that debate is such an important one that Richie's having with his friend in Google there, that we should be making sure that we've got as much information as we need now, because in a few months' time that may have vanished from the internet.
I think the way they're going to play it, if they've got a vaccine, is they may already have a vaccine, of course, and that maybe the top people have already been given it.
That leak, or supposed leak, that the guy in the White House saying, oh, it's okay, we've all been vaccinated. Well, he may have been just joking. But
it was certainly the case before the anthrax attacks after 9/11. George W. Bush and lots of people at the top in the US were all given anti-anthrax vaccines. That's before the anthrax was deployed. Now, you know, if it is a biological warfare attack by the US deep state, they may already have a vaccine which they're going to give them to their own people, but you won't necessarily get it. You might get a different kind of vaccine if you're just an ordinary punter.
Well, I mean, it does seem interesting, doesn't it? It's a public health issue, massive public health issue. You're saying, well, this is really important, we've got to enforce this because of public health. But actually, that censorship, due to public health, supposedly, could actually be quite useful if it came to a war, couldn't it?
Yes, because basically we're all going to be watched 24 hours a day. It's a 1984 style situation. We're at war with Eurasia. We've always been at war with Eurasia. And the real danger here, in my mind, is that some countries, as I say, in Nigeria, the Nigerian opposition were saying that the government of Babangida was pushing through compulsory COVID vaccination laws with Bill Gates funding it, giving them a $10 million bribe, and they haven't even got a vaccine. And they were saying, we haven't even got a vaccine yet, and you're already pushing this. Now, what may happen is they're going to push it on developing countries like Nigeria, say, you make this compulsory, otherwise the IMF are going to crash your economy. And so on and so forth.
Well, the signs are stacking up, Martin. I almost feel like that Jimi Hendrix song, All Along the Watchtower. You know, what we're seeing is cyber battles going on, economic battles going on. The only thing that seems to be not going on so far, well, also obviously space war going on, is the actual shooting war itself. It seems to be coming down the line.
The shooting war has been going on, as we mentioned, Syria earlier. Tens of thousands.
Well, there was no shooting of the airliner. It was just flying a jet.
No, I'm talking about the whole war. The whole war has been dragging on for nearly a decade.
And what do you make of the suggestion that because the United States and the NATO countries have been blocked from taking over Syria, that they've now directed their ire using this virus vaccine thing on the domestic population?
I think it's not just where I differ from what you might call the alt-right, as mentioned by Richie Allen there, is they see it all as a conspiracy by, a global conspiracy.
Globalist?
Globalist conspiracy. But as I've mentioned to you earlier, there is more than one dog in this fight. The Chinese Communist Party has got its own agenda.
But then you've
got the Russian state has got its own agenda.
Sure, Martin, but then you've got people like Henry Kissinger, who've got his feet in both camps. He's definitely got feet in the Chinese camp and in the US camp.
No, the thing about Kissinger is he's a super gangster, and he's basically, they decided at one stage they were going to negotiate with the Chinese in order to isolate the Russians, which they did. They also, of course, got the Saudis to lower the oil price in the 1980s to make the USSR bankrupt. Then, of course, they started to raise the oil price.
They tried to do that again recently.
Yeah, well, they're trying to raise the oil price now to bankrupt the Chinese. But, of course, the oil price is very low. The Chinese are just about to do a massive oil deal with Iraq and with Iran, which will sort their
Well, that will get the Americans
annoyed. Well, exactly. That's what this is all about. And it's quite possible.
Nord
Stream 2, they're trying to pressure the Germans not to, to build the pipeline. They're nearly finished. But any companies have anything to do with it, the Americans are banging the table. And of course, the British are going along with, yes, we don't want Nord Stream 2. But the Germans are going to turn around to the British and say, well, you don't try and
tell
us what to
do. Don't we want cheap gas?
Well, we could get some of it, yes, with no doubt it could be sold on to us cheaper, but we just do as we're told, Tony. The Germans, in fact, are now reaching the point, as the Japanese are, where they realise that if they line up with the Americans, they're going to end up with a war with China and Russia.
Well, if we are,
and that's not in their interest.
If we are,
we will just do as we're told.
If we are going to see this massive wave, as Richie is saying there, of internet censorship later this year, and potentially a war too, a lot of the chips that will be being cast at that point are Epstein chips, that is to say hard drives of all sorts of powerful and rich political and commercial figures, and all sorts, in fact maybe media people too and military people, who knows, that are on the Epstein hard drives of the films that were taken in his various houses, and including of course on his island and in his aircraft. And this, I find it fascinating that the mainstream press has really kind of skirted around all this. But Whitney Webb, as you pointed out many times, Martin, has done an absolutely brilliant job in really drilling into the origins of the Epstein Maxwell child sex trafficking ring. And there's this video which has come to my attention by various people sending it my way, thank you everybody, but it's called The Head of the Snake, about Les Wexner. Now, Martin, he's the probably known to most people, or the way he's impacted some people's lives, I'm not sure if it's yours, is by the lingerie shop Victoria's Secret. He's the owner of that around the world, a massive franchise, globalist franchise. So what do you make of this guy, Les Wexner?
Well, I don't know that much about him, but it wouldn't surprise me that a lingerie manufacturer is involved in child sex trafficking. I mean, there's plenty of overlap there, isn't
anyway,
there?
Anyway, fascinating interview between Maria Farmer, we're going to hear now, and Whitney Webb, your very own favourite Epstein journalist, Martin, about the video itself is called The Head of the Snake. It's about Les Wexner and exposing some of the real, basically the money power behind the Epstein Maxwell trafficking ring.
Epstein said this to me one time, but one day he pulled me aside and he said, Maria, look at this. You see all this? And I'm like, what? And he said, this room, all these decorators coming and going and all this stuff being, all this artwork and this beautiful furniture. You see it all? I said, yeah. And he said, I got it for a dollar. And this is the first time I heard the name Les Wexner. He said, Wexner gave it all to me. He'll do anything for me. When I called the FBI, I'm going to tell you what I told them. I said, I know this is strange, but I said, I have a report to make on someone that I've been working for that recently kidnapped me. And they said, who are you talking about? And I said, okay, well, his name is Jeffrey Epstein. And I said, and her name is Ghislaine Maxwell. And I said, but here's what's important. It also involves the Clinton family. It involves Bill Clinton for sure. It involves Donald Trump. And I said, but the most important one, and I said this, that he's the head of the snake, is Les Wexner. And they said, what do you think he is? And I said, he's Jewish mafia. And they said, what do you mean? And I said, what do you mean, what do I mean? Yeah, I said, what do you mean, what do I mean? I said, he's not Italian. He's Jewish, and he's mafia. I said, I can't be any clearer with you. And they said, how do you know he's Jewish mafia? And then I went on to list everything that I'd seen that was just so creepy. So one of the things that made me think it was all the passports. I know for a fact Epstein had an Israeli passport because he showed me, okay?
Yeah.
But Epstein, and I'll tell you about the Wexner, like why I think he's mafia, but I just want to say too why,
okay, sure.
I thought it was really sketchy that they had, like, how Ghislaine had all those passports. She had a passport, a French passport, an English passport, an Israeli passport, an American passport, and there was one other. And then it made me really mad that when the FBI raided the safe, I know what was in that safe. And it's not a regular safe. It's a whole room, just so you know. So when people say a safe, they think, oh, it's a safe. It's, Wexner had one, too. It's a whole room you walk into. And in that safe, he had a lot of photographs of children. And I know for about pictures of my sisters are in there. Because one of the people from his freaking office had told me they were in his briefcase, and he kept his briefcase in that safe. He also kept everything in there because he told me he kept it for Wexner, everything. And when I asked why they recorded everything all the time, I said, is Wexner really paranoid? And he said, yeah, that's one. Epstein said, yeah, that's one way of saying it. He keeps everything. He records it all. He said, I record everything, and I keep it for Wexner in the safe. Mm-hmm. So the first house I go to has pinhole cameras. Jeffrey's showing me. He's really proud of them. Second house I go to has pinhole cameras. He says, Wexner gave me this house for a dollar. Wexner gave me this for a dollar. Then I go to the apartment. They had pinhole cameras in the Victoria's Secret dressing room. Now, just to fast forward, when I was in Wexner's house, there are cameras every freaking, there were pinhole cameras throughout that thing. And Jeffrey again is like, oh, look at all the pinhole cameras. And Gilan says, you need to be careful. We can see everything. When I would go to the restroom or take a shower or anything, Gilan would call me, and from the speaker, and this is in New York, sometimes in London, in different places, she would say, get out of the loo, get off the toilet. She would start screaming at me. And I was on the toilet. And I'm like, what's happening? So then later Jeffrey's like, oh yeah, everything's being fed to Abigail. They're watching everything. They literally watched my every move, Whitney. Who does that? My point is, who has cameras everywhere? Sharpshooters, Doberman, mafia. That's why I said mafia. I'm like, I don't know anyone who lives like this. There were little pinhole cameras in that first mansion that Annie met Jeffrey in. And in the second mansion that he gave Jeffrey for a dollar, they were in the building that his brother owned on 66th Street.
The apartment
there were pinhole
building?
Cameras. And all these buildings that Wexner... Yes.
Okay.
All the buildings that Wexner had owned. Well, so here's where they were in the building that Wexner owned. They were in the Victoria's Secret stalls. Even though I had this driver's license... And Jeffrey had given me his SUV to use while I was there. But I couldn't go outside because, Whitney, there were sharpshooters. And no one discusses this. Actual freaking sharpshooters everywhere. And anyway, the weirdest part about being at Wexner's was it wasn't the basement because they had a basement. It was like below that. And there was a sauna in that room, like a huge sauna. And then they had like a vault. And then they had a door to an underground tunnel. And the only way I knew it was an underground tunnel was because their maid told me. I said, what is this door? Because I used to keep everything down there. And she said, oh, that's the tunnel that leads to the main house. I'm like, well, that's weird. Why would they do that? And she said, oh, you don't know? And I said, no. And she said, there's a giant 10,000 square foot floor that raises up when someone goes through that tunnel. And then they can enter the room secretly in, and then no one ever sees them. The floor raises up. She said it's 10,000 square feet. I mean, here's the thing. I lived there for 3 months, and I never once saw him. I saw Abigail on her horses, you know, go out to get her horses. You know, I could just see her and go out, but I never once saw him. And that's why I called him, like, the Wizard of Oz, because he was controlling everything, but no one ever saw the guy. Okay, so Wexner set up, just so you know. Nobody talks about this, but Whitney, before that first house, the house that Wexner gave to Jeffrey for a dollar, you know, it's like a, you know, the mansion that he raped all the children in. Before that house, there was another one. Yeah, Wexner gave him that one, and that thing was incredible. That's where Annie actually met him. I brought her over there. But that house, that mansion then was later given to Gilan recently. She sold it to give it to, or the townhouse, whatever. And that's how she settled with Virginia. She sold that. Oh my God, that woman. And she also had an apartment she took me to. So then she shows me all this stuff on the mantle. She takes me to the mantle. I'd never been in this apartment. It's on the Upper East Side. It was like probably 3,000 square feet. Really nice apartment. Like, I didn't have any friends that lived that well, you know? But it wasn't like, you know, showy like her other places. But she shows me on the mantle, and I'm like, oh, what's this? And she said, These are things my father took from the British Museum. And she's like, they're ancient relics. And I'm like, did she just say that? See, I could never repeat things to people because I think I was lying or something. And I'm like, what do you mean he took them? And she's like, he took them. He liked them. And she's like, this is an ancient Peruvian relic. You know, and she's showing me this stuff that was 22 karat gold that had been taken from graves, but out of the British Museum. I'm like, this is not good. And then she showed me all the royals. Like, she had about like 12 photo albums of growing up with the royals. Everyone thinks that they met at Oxford. No, they did
yeah,
not.
Yeah, I'm lying people. About that. Yeah.
She showed me pictures.
Yeah.
She also knew Fergie, like, a long, long time ago, because I saw pictures of her super young with Fergie before she was ever married to Prince Andrew.
Hmm.
And, I mean, it was weird. It's like they somehow she knew a lot of these people. Now, she knew Prince Andrew when they were definitely, like, I mean, she looked maybe 20. In some of these pictures, or maybe younger than that even, with Prince Andrew. And so I can date some of it by telling you that some of the photographs where they're all super young, they were making fun. I'm not kidding you. The pictures of Diana when she was just dating the prince, and Diana's in the corner crying in some of these pictures, and Guylaine's like, look there, we made her cry. Isn't that funny? We hated Diana. That's what she said. And I was wow. like, oh my God, that's horrible.
I just don't think I have as many supporters in that environment than I did.
You mean within the royal household?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They see me as a threat of some kind.
Guylaine answers to Wexner. I know that for a fact.
So you think she answers?
Well, Wexner is Israeli intelligence, 100%. And it was a sign that she would be under him. And I know that's where she got all of her funding to do this scam with Epstein. I know that.
So, Martin, so much in there. I mean, let's just go blow by blow, I suppose. The idea that Jeffrey Epstein was some sort of financial genius is blown out of the water here, because you've got him buying a house from Les Wexner for £1, a large New York apartment. So, I mean, of course, that's quite illegal to do that. If I own a house, I can sell it to you for £1 if I want. But this is clearly a way of, basically, it's like money laundering. In order to be the financial brains, the property brains behind a whole operation, and hardly any money changing hands, because you're just giving a load of stuff to Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein.
Well, if you read Whitney Webb's stuff, obviously that's an interview. But if you read her stuff on Mint Press News...
Yeah, Maria Farmer she was chatting to.
Yeah, on Mint Press News, it's got more detail. I mean, basically, going back to the 1940s, the mafia in the US wasn't run by Italians by and large. It was run by Jews. So Meyer Lansky basically created Las Vegas. And he worked very closely with the FBI and the CIA. And they basically had a program of what they called dirtying up. In other words, you get people involved in stuff which they would be very embarrassed to for it to come out publicly, and you use it to blackmail people. And they've been doing this for years and years and years.
And a whole load of passports.
Yeah.
And the
linkages are directly with the mafia, and the mafia itself is embedded with the CIA and Mossad. And this goes back to the 1940s. It's not some recent phenomenon. And of course,
what about MI6 as well?
Well, they fish in the same ponds. But you know, this has been going on for a very long time, and basically, virtually anybody in a senior position, either in the political or business world, are blackmailed by these kind of networks.
So the idea is that you blackmail a whole load of people, doesn't matter if they're bright or not, probably good idea if they're not bright, like Keir Starmer, and then they will just do as they're told, or Boris Johnson, or anybody.
Yeah, I mean, they don't necessarily go for individual politicians. They go for everybody.
Well, surely the idea is that you get someone where they're young, and then once you've got dirt on them, then they will be fast-tracked into a position of power somewhere.
Yes, and also, of course, it's just an insurance policy. So if they ever step out of line, you can then say, hang on a minute, we've got all this stuff.
So if you see a politician on television that reminds you of a zombie or a puppet, it might be because that's exactly what they are.
Listen, the State of Israel is a very small country with only a few million inhabitants, and it's very paranoid about everybody trying to take it down.
But this isn't just about Israel, surely. It's about the faction, the kind of, should we say, British Israel faction in the UK, and the Christian Zionist faction in the US too.
It's hard to know exactly where the power lies within these structures, but it's pretty clear where the general thrust is. The mafia in Russia is largely Semyon Mogilevich, who's the top mafioso, capi tutti capi. He is Jewish, Jewish Russian. He's got Israeli citizenship. There are some estimates that up to 40% of the Israeli economy is controlled by the Russian mafia. Now, the Russian mafia, what happens in the mafia is that everybody gets together. There's only one mafia in the end. And it's linked to intelligence services, it's linked to high finance, and it's geared around objectives of control.
And what about finance? Obviously, this is a big thing for the mafia because a lot of people have pointed the finger at the City of London there.
Well, the City of London is a major focus for all of this activity. In the 1980s, after the Big Bang, what went on in the City of London, the New York Stock Exchange was still relatively regulated. So all the really nasty stuff, the stuff that, the kinky stuff that you couldn't do in Wall Street, you could do it in London, which led to massive increase in financial investments in Britain. Britain is the money laundering capital of the world. Meanwhile, you have lame brains like Boris Johnson claiming that we are the ones who are trying to bring clean politics to the and to the third world and prevent them from stealing and so on. But of course, all the money that the Saudi royal family steals, where do you think it ends up? It ends up in the City of London, just like all the money that the Russian mafia steals. That's where it ends up, in the City of London. And of course, there are alternative money laundering centres. Las Vegas is one of them. Delaware in the US is becoming another. Nevada. And these networks, the criminal economy is absolutely embedded within the mainstream financial economy, as the former police officer, what's his name?
Rowan Bosworth Davis
has said on this show, who used to be part of the Met fraud squad. And people have no real idea about this. They watch.
He used to talk about the joy of kicking down the doors of blue blood bankers at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, but eventually, of course, what happened was he was shuffled out, and none of these people were prosecuted. Because he's basically just too much of a small... He's become a criminologist.
Well, I think some were, but then there was a big trial, the Blue Arrow trial in 1993, I think, which was where they got some of the real top bankers. And that was... they were given a suspended sentence, first of all, and then the Court of Appeal dropped the suspended sentence. So the message went out very clearly, don't bother with these top people again.
That's right, and that's when he resigned from the Met Fraud Squad and became a criminology professor. And of course, he's submitted papers to
evidence
to the British government.
Yeah, saying that it was organised crime. It was analogous. That basically the City of London's activities fitted all of the main international definitions of organised crime.
It does, and they do, and they are.
So. Anyway, I thought I did talk about it at the beginning, the Magnitsky Act. Maybe we could just start, Martin, with a little introduction to this, because it is the legislation which enables an arbitrary targeting of specific individuals. This has a massive chilling effect. And I think this is one of the things that's not discussed anywhere in any of the mainstream press, is the idea that you may travel to Britain and then you may be named under the British Magnitsky Act or the US Magnitsky Act and you're travelling to the United States. That can mean your visa is instantly rescinded and that your assets are all confiscated. Any of your assets in that country are confiscated. A little bit like, it reminds me a little bit about what happened to Meng Wanzhou, you know, the Huawei chief financial officer. When she went to Canada, suddenly this completely unexpected thing happened to her and she's imprisoned. And now apparently she's going to be extradited to the United States, although I'm not sure the Canadians will really dare to do that. It's an absolutely reckless thing to do. And it's caused all sorts of trouble, obviously, in Hong Kong as well. And the fallout from that, the knock-on effects have been horrendous for 7 million people who live in Hong Kong. Just that one act of the Canadians arresting and then saying they're going to pass her on. But anyway, the Magnitsky Act has this effect. The idea it really being to stop anybody wealthy and powerful in Russia from actually travelling anywhere into Western countries where this act is in effect.
Yeah, and if you look at the Magnitsky case, Bill Browder, who's the billionaire behind all of this, Magnitsky was basically defrauding the Russian tax office. And they Browder, who was one of his business partners, paid a Russian journalist to produce a documentary about it. And this Russian journalist went off to produce a documentary about what had happened to Magnitsky, having been directed by the financer of the project that Magnitsky was innocent and that the Russians had set him up and so on. And then he concluded that Magnitsky wasn't innocent and that the Russians were right and that he was basically a fraudster. And of course, that documentary has been suppressed. But I think we could probably put a link up to it on our show page. I'm sure it's out there. And on the back of this, which is essentially fraudulent, both the US and Britain have now had Magnitsky Acts, which allow them to just designate any foreign person, or even presumably a British person, as being a human rights abuser, etc., etc., and therefore their assets can be seized and they can be imprisoned and so on, without any court of law.
That's right.
No process, nothing.
There is no process whatsoever. You just are named by the government and closed down, effectively. The British Magnitsky Act was passed in May 2018, just after the Skripal affair. So that's another thing that, if you're scratching your head wondering what that was all about, it was about making sure this act took place in Britain. So let's have a listen now to Alex Craner. I spoke to him earlier this week. He's the author of a book called The Grand Deception, The Truth About Bill Browder, The Magnitsky Act and Anti-Russia Sanctions, and that was published in 2018. And I think you'll find this is a long interview, but it includes a fascinating section about the Epsteins and some of the totally unreported facts to do with the court case that's going on between Epstein's banker and Deutsche Bank, I believe, the people who were financing Epstein. So they're trying to find out where the money was going, where it was going to and from, and suddenly people start dying who are supposed to be appearing in court, and the judges who are supposed to be presiding over cases get threatened, and there's an attempt to murder them. So this is a quite wide-ranging interview, really, looking at UK-US-Russia relations, but particularly explaining how this Magnitsky Act works with Alex Craner, I did earlier this week.
I'm Alex Craner. I'm a former hedge fund manager. I'm a market analyst and commodities trader based in Monaco, originally from Croatia. I have published two books and one article in a peer-reviewed journal, and one of the books has been banned, deleted from Amazon at the request of one Jonathan Weiner, from who was the advisor of John Kerry of in the Obama administration, from the State Department. And the book was about Bill Browder and the Magnitsky Act, which has been widely described as the opening salvo of the new Cold War between the United States and Russia. So that's basically where I'm at and the things that I've been interesting myself with over the...
Okay, I think, we're hearing a lot at the moment in the UK about Magnitsky Act. Can we start, please, with, who was Magnitsky? What was his first name? Who was he? And who is this Bill Browder guy?
We're talking about Sergei Magnitsky. Sergei Magnitsky was the employee of the Moscow-based law firm called Firestone & Duncan, which was established by one Jamie Firestone. This company worked for Bill Browder's Hermitage Capital, which used to be the largest foreign-owned hedge fund in Russia. It was managed by Bill Browder. Bill Browder is a former American, now British subject, because he changed his citizenship. Very likely an MI6 asset, and he was the man at the center of events that generated the narrative with which the Magnitsky Act had been lobbied through U.S. Congress in 2012. Again, I'll repeat, the Magnitsky Act is considered as the opening salvo of the new Cold War between the United States and Russia. This passed in 2012 during the Obama administration.
I mean, how can it be part of a Cold War? This is just about economics and about money.
Yes and no. Basically, the Magnitsky Act ostensibly is a piece of legislature that protects human rights and punishes the human rights abusers. But this is merely the facade. In reality, the Act sanctions Russian individuals or firms who are seen to have been involved in human rights abuses. The nature of the legislation is problematic because it does not involve any due process. So basically what happens is that some unnamed and unknown individual, some bureaucrat from the United States Treasury Department, at their discretion, can put Tony Gosling on the Magnitsky list. From that point on, Tony Gosling's U.S. assets and any bank accounts in the United States will be frozen, and you will no longer be able to travel to the United States, and you will have no recourse, no possibility to confront your accusers, no possibility of knowing what you're being accused of, or to be able to clear your name again. So the question is why these bizarre punishments for people who are merely accused of abusing human rights. My own explanation is because I have looked into this in some detail, and I've pondered the problem a little bit. My explanation is that basically we have to go back to the 1990s. What happened in the 1990s is that Russia transitioned from a communist economy to capitalist economy. So you were right, we're coming back to money. But it has broader ramification than just some amount of money over some individual business deal or interest. Basically, what happened is that during this transition in Russia from communism to capitalism, The Western financial interests have been able to spirit away from Russia to offshore centers, conservatively between $200 billion and $600 billion worth of Russia's wealth. These are conservative estimates. It could have been very much higher. And we're not talking about market cap in a bloated stock market. We're talking book value of assets, right? So this is extremely large amount.
Okay, now, so the context of this is, you know, you had the oligarchs going around in Russia in the 1990s under Yeltsin buying quite cheap a lot of the massive state assets. And of course, you know, as a communist country, there were all sorts of major industries controlled by the government. And those were often foreign interests. So I suppose the idea really there is that they would buy these assets up and then keep those assets abroad rather than within Russia, because they felt, particularly in the 1990s, they may have been right, that Russia wasn't a very safe place to keep their money.
Well, yeah, especially if you're stealing it, you know, because the, you know, various mechanisms were used to plunder Russia's wealth. But basically, one of the biggest chunks of this was to place the key jewels of Russian economy into the hands of a handpicked, recruited group of oligarchs. They have been recruited well in advance and groomed for this role by Western financial interests. I think virtually all of them from the Komsomol, which was the youth organization of the Russian Communist Party. So these were all sons of communist functionaries of the Russian.
So, I mean,
soldiers.
You say well beforehand. How far beforehand? Because that make you suspect that there were a whole bunch of people ready and waiting to pounce, and that it was all understood that the Glasnost was going to happen and that the communism was going to fall.
Well, there have been, and I unfortunately can't give you the name now, but there have been trips and meetings and pre-arrangements between the Western financial interests and the Soviet authorities going back into the 70s at the very least. So the banking reforms started well ahead of the Glasnost. The banking reforms which enabled these oligarchs and other entrepreneurs to register private banks in Russia with as little as $100,000 in capital and in how do you call it in the founding capital. And virtually with no regulation whatsoever. So there was some banking regulation that was introduced, but it was really not being abided by very strictly. And essentially, anybody who could walk in with $100,000 could create a bank in the Soviet Union already before the transition.
Okay, so how did all this with the oligarchs buying up all this state assets, how does this relate to come round to Magnitsky? Because that all started around
about 1980.
There was a collapse, for people that don't know or don't remember or weren't alive, there was a massive collapse around about 1990 in the Russian economy. And the 1990s were really the Yeltsin era. Most of them were the Yeltsin era. And Yeltsin was really allowing a free hand for the oligarchs to do what they wanted until the end of the 1990s, the arrival 2000 of Vladimir Putin. So how does what's happened with Magnitsky and the timing of that fit in with the plunder of Russia?
Okay, so that's exactly the right question. Basically, this has been my hypothesis, but I've already come across several people that agree with me on this, and then certain other experiences that are related to this also corroborate this hypothesis. And my hypothesis basically is that once all this wealth, once the ownership over all these key assets disappeared from Russia to various offshore jurisdictions, what happened when Putin came to power is he wanted to reverse some of these transfers of wealth. And so his government started to investigate the transfers of wealth, all these transactions, and to trace the assets, where they went, so that they may be able to recover them. Now, to do this, you know, you can investigate in Russia what happened in Russia, but then to be able to investigate the transaction as they went offshore, you need to go through the jurisdictions like London and New York and the Cayman Islands and Cyprus and so forth, and Switzerland. And so in order to investigate all this, you would eventually have to go to these foreign jurisdictions. You would have to file various lawsuits, freedom of information requests, and so forth. And this is a very, very important part of the process, because if you go through the legitimate judicial process, then what happens is that various participants in this and various witnesses to this are going to be interviewed and deposed, and official documents are going to be taken out, and basically the whole affair comes out black on white on record, and then you cannot reverse it anymore and you cannot hide it anymore. And so the further you allow these investigations to go on, the closer the process gets to the culprits of the great plunder of Russia in the 1990s. And so my view is that there is this rush to introduce Magnitsky legislature in all the key Western jurisdictions, exactly in order to frustrate this process so that the Russian investigators cannot trace back the assets to their ultimate beneficiaries. So that, you know, like if somebody wants to conduct an investigation, they can immediately be placed on the Magnitsky list. At that point, they can no longer travel. The witnesses can no longer travel. And now, one of the people who have agreed with me when I discussed this with her was Natalia Veselnitskaya, who is a Moscow-based lawyer and who did have some run-ins with Bill Browder and the Russiagate affair. But then, over the last few years, we've already seen that, for example, when the International Criminal Court in The Hague wanted to investigate certain U.S. and Israeli persons for suspicion of war crimes, that Mike Pompeo said that they would rescind their visas, that they would deny them visas for the United States. So this is obviously seen as a handy mechanism to frustrate certain judicial processes from running their course and reaching their full conclusions.
So the Magnitsky Act was passed in 2012 in the United States. In
correct.
The UK, there was an equivalent act passed. And you do wonder if this is just because Britain is now part of the US empire. In May 2018, just after the Skripal affair. So Sergei Skripal and Yulia Skripal were apparently gassed with some nerve agent in Salisbury, although there were various different people say different things about that whole affair. As a former BBC reporter in Salisbury for a year myself, I'm extremely sceptical about the official version of events there, knowing that, for example, that the chief constable of Wiltshire Police, it was his first day in his new job because the previous guy, who'd been extremely good, had been removed, scapegoated effectively. So the new guy didn't have any real experience policing Wiltshire when this event happened. It was his first day. Plus, there are lots of anomalies in that account, not least of which is this apparent perfume bottle and some apparent confusion between the whether this was a professional outfit, if these so-called Russian agents were having sex with prostitutes, smoking cannabis, and this sort of thing. And there's a great deal of contention about, you know, what really happened in Salisbury. And then the other thing is, of course, that Sergei Skripal was involved with Christopher Steele in creating this Russia dossier in order to try and make out that President Trump had been using Russian help in order to get elected. His biggest crime, it seems, of Skripal to me is that he was then considering and wrote a letter to Vladimir Putin saying that he wanted to actually now to return to Russia. He got fed up with Britain. He didn't trust the Brits anymore. And at which point suddenly this incident happens. And of course, he's not going back to Russia now. The British may have been very concerned that he was going to appear on Russian TV, etc., talking about how MI6 had been working with him and Christopher Steele to fabricate a whole dossier of evidence about Russia and Trump. But anyway, look, the point being here is that this was the reason used in Britain to impose this Magnitsky Act here. So what do you make of that, Britain sort of falling in straight into line then with the United States a few years later, 6 years later in May 2018?
Well, I think that the way certain key legislature is being passed in the Western jurisdiction is not clearly a transparent above board process. I think that when a certain act has to pass, there are ways to pressure the lawmakers in every nation and to make.
I suppose that if the British are desperate at the moment for a trade deal with the United States, that might be a bit of leverage that would persuade the British to say, yes, we'll do this deal, this act, pass this Magnitsky Act.
Yes, but I suspect that there's worse than that, you know, like, because I suspect that there are control files on key decision makers in the whole hierarchy of the establishment. And that these control files can be used to lean on these decision makers to make the right decisions, to vote the right way, and to make laws passed that need to be passed. And so, you know, like we've seen this kind of stuff again and again. You know, like when the decision is to be made to go and run over Libya, there's hardly any debate about that. So, you know, it's there's clearly illegitimate aspects to the process, and the Magnitsky acts are very, very important to cover up the tracks of the great plunder of Russia in the 1990s. So by whatever means, by hook or by crook, there's ways to lean on the lawmakers to vote the right way and to make this legislature pass. There's also the process that sometimes you insert things into certain laws that most the legislator want to see passed, right? The pork barrel spending kind of laws, and you package it together with the Magnitsky sanction, and then everybody said like, okay, well, let's pass this so we can get all these other goodies. So there are many different ways that certain laws can be obtained, not above board, not in a transparent way, but effectively they do become the law, and then the administration and the bureaucracy can act in accordance. And then a certain, you know, certain process that would need to be completed, i.e. these Russian investigations into the plunder of the 1990s, can no longer be completed, and they're completely frustrated at the root.
Well, the British Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, says if you're a kleptocrat or an organised criminal, you won't be able to launder your money in the City of London anymore.
Well, you know, that sounds like a solemn declaration, but I would take it with a giant grain of salt, you know, because when it comes to money, you know, this adherence to human rights and to morality is just disingenuous and untrue. We've seen, for example, in 2012 also. For example, HSBC has been completely let off the hook with a small parking ticket after they have been caught laundering at least $7 billion for the Mexican drug cartels. That's, you know, how is laundering money for the Mexican drug cartels better than laundering money for Russian oligarchs? I mean, why is one category morally superior to the other?
The Magnitsky Act has also been mentioned this week in the Russian election interference report, which has come out from the Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee. They've said that Britain has badly underestimated the threat to British elections from Russia.
Well, Russia has been generally blamed for every bad thing happening in the West, but you know, to me it makes very little sense. It's a constant thing. It's, you know, Russia has been blamed for undermining people's unity on the issue of vaccinations. They've been blamed for the downing of the Malaysia airliner over Ukraine. They've been blamed for the election of Donald Trump, for Brexit, for the Skripal poisoning, they've been blamed for sending agents to the Czech Republic to assassinate Czech politicians because they voted in favor of removing some Soviet era monument. And the list just goes on and on and on. Basically, anything bad that can sour public perception of Russia gets a great deal of media attention and practically like a public relations push. So I am very skeptical about it. I don't see Russia as this great global villain that does all these bad things while all the other countries are just like well-behaved children who never do anything wrong. So everything bad is obviously to be blamed on Russia. I think there are reasons why it is very important to the Western establishment to maintain a hostile stance towards Russia. There's more than one reason. I will give you the two main ones that I see. One is that we have a financial system that's like an inverted pyramid with a very, very small base and with a very, very large base and a very, very small tip. Okay. And it's going to implode. The Western financial system requires a healthy collateral in order to grow, right? Russia is an enormously resource-rich country. They have 16% debt to GDP. So if Western financial interests could gain financial control over this resource wealth in Russia, that collateral would give a new lease of life to the Western financial system. So removing the Putin regime, which is pushing back, and putting in some other kind of regime like the Yeltsin regime that would enable Western financial interests to take control over Russia's wealth is one important reason why there's the hostile stance towards the Putin regime. The other one is that one of the most powerful segments of our society is our military-industrial complex, not just in the United States, but in France, in the United Kingdom, even in Germany. And for this military-industrial complex to continue bilking their societies and their population for more and more and more untold billions and trillions, we need to have an enemy. Why should we be buying all these fighter jets and all these rockets and ships and God knows what, and building all these military bases everywhere if we have no enemy? Like, if we can cooperate constructively with Russia, trade, travel back and forth, and develop, let's say, civilian business, butter versus guns, then we don't need so many weapons, right? We don't need to buy all these weapons and support all these military contractors, right? So it's extremely important to have an enemy. So the public image of Russia has to be maintained as some aggressive, nasty power that we have to constantly be on the lookout against, and that is always a threat to us. So we always have to prepare for a big fight and a big war. So that's two very, very important reasons why the maintaining hostile stance towards Russia is very, very important to the Western financial and corporate establishment.
So what happened? How did Putin manage to get in 2000 if he was going to completely turn the tables on the international financial system? I mean, that sounds to me as if it was an incredible operation he managed there. How did he do it?
Okay, this is partly a mystery to me, and I have tried very hard to understand how he got in power. And it's a very, very interesting story. In many dimensions, it's very mysterious. He somehow ended up being friends with Henry Kissinger, among other people, because his boss in St. Petersburg. So he was an aide to St. Petersburg Mayor Anatoly Sobchak, right? And Anatoly Sobchak was apparently a Henry Kissinger loyalist. So Vladimir Putin became known and noted by Henry Kissinger and probably other powerful people in the West. Over the years, Vladimir Putin has done some work where he helped the Yeltsin family avoid legal liabilities for some corruption affairs that started to emerge late towards towards Boris Yeltsin's presidency. And so in this way, he gained the confidence of these powerful people and of the oligarchs. So the biggest oligarch at the time was Boris Berezovsky, who later ended up defecting to London. But Boris Berezovsky himself was very keen on bringing Vladimir Putin to become first the prime minister and then eventually to replace Boris Yeltsin. And having reviewed Boris Berezovsky's statements, he believed that he would be able to run the country by basically having Vladimir Putin there as a figurehead and then running the show in the background while Vladimir Putin passively enjoys his life of eating and fishing and golfing as a figurehead president. how Vladimir Putin and people around him managed to persuade these people that this would be possible, I don't know. But it seems to me that there was a network of clever people from the KGB who helped out, you know, who networked and made all this happen. And I think one of them is gone now. His name is going to escape me, but he died recently. He used to be the chief of the KGB. God, forgive me. I just forget his name now, but he was, he founded one of the political parties with the Moscow mayor, Yuri Lushkov. So, the old.
Okay, well, that's fascinating. I mean, I know I was reading recently that Berezovsky and Putin in the early 1990s were off having skiing trips in Switzerland, and they were very, you know, personally very friendly. So, you know, what you say makes a lot of sense. How do you think this is going to all play out, though? Because this is the big question about the Magnitsky Act in the US and in Britain is if it does mean that you've got a complete cutoff with some of the most powerful and wealthiest people in Russia from the rest of the world, and they're not allowed to investigate or get back any of their assets. You've got 49 people, Dominic Raab now has said, are on the British Magnitsky list. These are specific individuals. As you say, they're just named, and then from that moment on, their assets are seized. They can't travel to Britain, etc. One does wonder what would happen if they were named as a Magnitsky Act person whilst they were abroad. Of course, just the fact that you might be put on that list would mean that you would very, very unlikely to want to travel to Britain. So it has an immense, which is completely unspoken about, immense chilling effect on relations between the nations. I mean, it does seem as if we're heading down the line here towards some much more serious conflict if they're prepared to take measures like this, Alex.
Yes. There's a great deal of moral hazard with this Magnitsky legislature. It is designed to protect a narrow group of vested interest in the Western financial circles, to the detriment of ordinary people and businessmen who might see much, much better interest in, let's say, cooperating and trading with Russia, in exporting their wares, on buying Russian products and sending them. So it's bad for the most people. It's only good for those who have participated in the pirate raid on Russia in the 1990s. How this plays out, I am not sure. It is very clear that the Russians are extremely persistent, that they are very scrupulous and careful not to discredit themselves by doing things like the Skripal affair. I do not believe for a second that they poisoned the Skripals in Salisbury. I believe that they are very careful to go through the legitimate judicial process, because whatever victories you score in that way cannot easily be reversed. Whereas if you do something bad under below board, let's say, this only serves to harm your interest in the longer term. I think that they will be persisting in this. I think that from their side, they will continue conducting investigations and putting pressures on other governments in various ways to participate with them. For example, with the government of Cyprus, with the government of Spain, and probably more in the intelligence collecting ways in places like Bermuda, Cayman Islands, British Virgin Islands, and so what, to continue to collect documentary evidence of what happened to their assets in the 1990s. At the same time, I think that Russia wants to, in a real way, counter the Western Empire. You say it's American Empire. I think it's not necessarily American Empire. I think it's more British Empire that has taken the United States as its military muscles since the end of World War I. But regardless, this is an empire that has its vested interests. I think their headquarters in the city of London, and that the sub headquarters are on Wall Street.
And I think that they are following strictly the logic of empire of having to eliminate every rival. And I think that at this time, their house of cards is starting to implode. So they're acting in more and more reckless ways. And I think that they're endangering themselves further because the time is running out for them. I think that one of the very interesting battles that are emerging there are related to Jeffrey Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell affair, and now the court case against Deutsche Bank for laundering money for Jeffrey Epstein. We have seen already that Jeffrey Epstein's private banker has committed suicide. We have seen that somebody sent an assassin to the house of judge who was assigned this case against Deutsche Bank. And this to me, because, you know, assassination is very, very serious affairs. I remember years ago, I watched a lecture of a KGB defector in the United States from the 1980s. His name was Yuri Bezmenov. He was explaining that even KGB is extremely reluctant to do assassinations. And he explained that the reason is because when you decide to kill somebody, you have to kill actually three people. You have to kill your target, you have to kill the assassin, and then you have to kill the assassin. And all of this is necessary to completely cover your tracks. And now we have already seen that the assassin who was sent to this judge's house had already been assassinated. So they've already done two assassinations. Well, they haven't killed the judge, but they botched it and they killed her son and critically injured her husband. Her name now escapes me, but then the suspected assassin was found dead also, apparently of suicide with two gunshots to the head. And so the fact that the powers that be have resorted to these kinds of measures tells me that the crosshairs are very close to the target and that they're getting extremely nervous. I believe that in addition to, let's say, Russian government being a rival for power to this empire builders network, I think that the Trump administration is also opposed to this network, because it seems to me that Trump administration has been putting pressure on them with arresting Jeffrey Epstein, with arresting Ghislaine Maxwell, with starting these court cases against Deutsche Bank and so forth. So I think that they are in trouble. I think that the walls are closing in around them. And they're resorting to increasingly desperate measures. So I think it's been getting interesting, and I think it's going to continue to get even more interesting, but God only knows how it plays out, and I think it will be very difficult to predict what's going to happen. I only hope that we will be able to avoid the hot war between the Western powers and China or Russia or both, because I think that would be extremely, extremely destructive, and the world would never be the same.
Well, that's interesting. You mentioned Kissinger earlier, because he has some very strong connections both in China and in the United States.
Yes, of course, and in Russia as well. You know, there are always these networks of powerful people who are not necessarily, you know, like you cannot treat any nation as a monolith. You know, you always have, you know, like you always have, take Russia, you'll have part of the power network who are, let's call it, deplorable patriotic Russians. And then you have the Euro-Atlanticists who are more loyal to London and New York, who will keep friendships with people like Henry Kissinger and George Soros and so forth, and who will be running the media for them and their open society foundations and so forth. You probably have the same situation in China, and you have probably the same situation in the United States as well as Britain, perhaps. And so you always, well, I think that what we're seeing now is a bit of a civil war between these interests among themselves, possibly in China. And unfortunately, I don't know very much about the internal Chinese politics, but definitely in Russia and definitely in the United States. And I think that these internal conflicts will determine how these countries fall in line or not with respect to the empire.
But, I mean, yeah, certainly the most interesting stuff you've been talking about is Epstein. I mean, you're also saying, though, aren't you, that you think that, that the City of London is still kind of at the centre, that they're telling the Americans what to do. I think there's a lot of people in the UK that feel that the Americans are telling us what to do, but maybe it's just the city telling the Americans, who then tell the rest of Britain what to do. But the other question, of course, is that there's a very close link, quite clearly, between the Maxwell family and Epstein and the Israelis. So where do the Israelis fit in? Because they're, you know, we're looking at a, you know, basically organized crime networks that are centered around those three countries.
Well, I think that for all practical purposes, you can see all these, you can take Israel as part of the Western establishment, right? And I think that all the in the Western establishment, all the intelligence agencies cooperate on certain things together, right? So German intelligence, Israeli intelligence, Italian intelligence, British intelligence, Australia, New Zealand, Sweden, Spain, France, and the United States and Canada.
NATO.
They all form intelligence networks that closely cooperate. I'll give you an example. When Croatia joined the NATO, one of the preconditions was that NATO. In certain important segments, NATO takes over control over Croatia's intelligence services, right? So, you know, if something need be done in Croatia or on Croatian assets or laws or whatever you have, then they will find a network of people who will be able to cooperate with them. And I think that the same is true for Mossad, for French intelligence services and so forth. It's all in the same network. And something you mentioned a moment ago that I wanted to come back to, I forgot, forgive me, so we'll just move on.
So I just wanted to say what you, whether you think that Maxwell, who's, you know, certainly her father, was known to be very closely connected to Israel's Secret Service. I mean, how does that fit in? Because there's a lot of discussion on the surface about this whole Ghislaine Maxwell, Jeffrey Epstein business, but it seems pretty obvious that there was a purpose. What they were doing was effectively, it was a blackmail operation. They were bringing powerful people in, having them filmed on the aircraft, in the various houses, etc., and that they now have a great big hard drive full of films of powerful people with young kids, teenagers, etc. I just wonder what you think, you know, where that hard drive is. Is it in a nutshell? I don't know whether it matters. Is it in London, Tel Aviv, or Washington?
Huh. That's a very good question. You know what? My hunch would be in Washington. That would be my hunch, but I could be wrong. But, you know, this whole thing, this whole affair with Maxwell and Epstein is going back to, you know, moments ago we were talking about these powerful networks being able to lean on decision makers to make the right decisions in order to pass these kinds of legislations like Magnitsky Act by way of having control files. And I forgot, I didn't explain what I mean by control files, but basically, if you have evidence of somebody's wrongdoing, for example, engaging in illicit sex act or receiving bribery or so forth, then you can influence them to do your bidding in the legislature, in courts, or wherever it need be. So this is what I meant by the control files, and very possibly the work of Robert Maxwell, of his daughter Ghislaine Maxwell, of Jeffrey Epstein, has been to generate these control files, right? And I think that the panic about this is exactly that the wrong people will gain control of these control files. And I suspect that to an extent this has already happened. And I think that if you see the things that have been happening in the FBI, you know, like Donald Trump has been able to take control over the FBI, where when he joined the administration, when he came to the White House, the FBI was completely under control of the Obama era loyalists, which are, I think, people who are loyal to the globalist empire rather than deplorable patriotic Americans. And I think that the other agencies that he has to wrestle control of are the national security agencies, the Treasury Department, the Judicial Department and the Pentagon and the CIA, of course. And I think that gaining these control files will accelerate the, let's call it, the deplorable segment of the U.S. administration to gain control of these key agencies.
Yeah, one of the interesting things is, of course, on that hard drive will almost be a control file on Donald Trump, which might have, maybe excited him to make sure that that was in his hands rather than some foreign powers. But look, I mean, I've worked, in mainstream press in the BBC in London, Alex. You've worked in doing hedge fund managing. Can you just give us, from your experience doing the, quite high-level financial operation, for ordinary folks out there who've never really been part of this world, how the world really works in a nutshell?
Well, I think that the skeleton of the society today is its financial system, because everything depends on the financial system, right? We're going into slightly philosophical realm here, but we are all born into this world which is astonishingly abundant, right? There's great abundance everywhere around us. If you look at the, you look around yourself, you see the houses, the apartments, the cars, the airplanes, the yachts, the amount of food that we eat and that we waste and so forth is just phenomenal, right? 100 years ago, we were less than a billion. Today, we are allegedly more than 7 billion. Still, most people eat. So there's this great abundance that's nourishing us. The problem is that most of us have no access to this abundance, because the ticket to this abundance is the money, right? So you can't just have a roof over your head and food in your belly. You have to pay for it. And to pay for it, you need money. And somebody controls the money. And they say, no, you cannot have this unless you can pay for it with dollars or pounds or euros or what have you. You cannot just give somebody hair in exchange for a meal, right? I mean, you can, but it's, strictly speaking, is discouraged, and in many ways it's illegal. So to get access to this abundance, you need money. So we are all dependent mm-hmm. on money, and we all need to do what we need to do to earn this money. And so these are the chains. These are the chains that are restricting our liberty, that are restricting our access to the livelihood, to the comforts of life, to the joys of life. And the system has ways of always putting pressure on us, making it always harder and harder to earn the money to make a living. And now we've come to the point where it's become so hard and the system is so over-leveraged with debt that something will break, and something is breaking, and the people who are controlling this system, right? And this is the essentially a franchise based in the city of London. So other central banks are basically franchise of this central bank, which is the Bank of England. They want to clear the deck. They want to start over, but while preserving the power structure as it is and the control in their own hands. The way this has been done traditionally is through world wars. This time around, they're having a difficult time getting a war going, but they have proven themselves to be very, very persistent in this way as well. So, they try to get a skirmish going on between India and Pakistan, between Russia and Ukraine, between Greece and Turkey, between the Venezuela and Colombia, between, you name it, Saudi Arabia and Yemen, Saudi Arabia and Iran and so forth. So anywhere where they can throw a spark, they try. And I don't know, this time around it doesn't seem to be working, but we still have to be on the lookout. And I think that we still have to be very careful not to find ourselves in World War III, because once the war gets going, I promise you everything changes. Today we can have a nuanced discussion about the Russians and about the Chinese and about the Americans and the empire and so forth. Once the war gets going, the society polarizes very quickly, and then you're with us or you're against us. Political dissent is tantamount to treason, and everybody has to line up behind their government, whether they like it or not. So I think that the way to do this is to make sure that the truth is accessible to the people, that people can discuss in terms of truthful information rather than in terms of lies and propaganda. And hopefully the great majority of the population will not have the stomach for war, and we can avoid it.
Fascinating. Alex Craner, thanks ever so much for joining us.
Tony, thank you very much for having me, and all the best to you and to your listeners.
So that's Alex Craner there, talking to me from Croatia earlier this week. Kind of unique guy, really, Martin, in that he's, although he's worked in these financial circles, he's almost like a kind of poacher turned, well, gamekeeper turned poacher. He's now very critical of a lot of high finance, and even though he's still actually working in it, and particularly of Bill Browder in this Magnitsky Act, which it turns out it's actually an extremely political move, and it's almost extrajudicial. The idea that some official somewhere can just write someone's name down on a piece of paper and all their assets are seized, it does sort of go, doesn't it sniff to you of a bit of extrajudicial process here?
Well, definitely. These things have always been going on, but it's intensifying because of the nature of the crisis. You know, a Marxist would say that it's because of the falling rate of profit and all the rest of it underlying things. But, you know, that's a pretty comprehensive view of what's going on.
One of the big revelations we've got there, I mean, he was fantastic that he covered this, basically a news story this week that we might otherwise have covered, but he covered it for us. And this is the appointment last Wednesday, the 15th of July, 2020, of the judge, Esther Salas, on the court case to do with the Deutsche Bank and Jeffrey Epstein's bank accounts, and that happened on the Sunday. On the Wednesday, a FedEx person turned up, very much like that film The 3 Days of the Condor, if you've ever seen that, with Robert Redford. If you haven't, you should. Terrific film from the 1970s. A man from FedEx turns up at the door, and as the son opens the door, her son, the judge's son, opens the door with her husband, Mark Anderville, stood behind. The guy just opens fire with a hail of bullets and kills her son. I suppose it doesn't really matter whether it was the judge that's killed or the son. There's a very clear message, a very clear mafia message being sent to the judge that if you try and pursue this court case, you're going to die, or people around you are going to die. So you better back off right now.
And also the guy who carried out the assassination then assassinated himself, supposedly, with two bullets in the head.
Allegedly, okay. Allegedly. Now, I've looked into this guy. He's the guy they've saying caused the assassination. The only person who, of course, will know that is, can identify him, is Mark, Judge Esther Salas's husband. And there's, just looking at Roy Den Hollander, who's the guy who's accused of carrying out this assassination, dressed as a FedEx delivery driver in Rockland, New York, where Judge Esther Salas lives. He's actually a lawyer. He's an anti-feminist lawyer. He's got his own website, and he takes court cases, basically a sort of Fathers for Justice type lawyer. Doesn't really sound to me as if a wealthy lawyer would really need to be a hitman for the mafia.
Well, it may be that he didn't do it, but his name is on the charge sheet.
Well, one of the things Alex is talking about there is, well, if you're going to assassinate somebody, you've got to assassinate the assassin, and then you've got to assassinate the person who killed the assassin as well, in order to completely cover your tracks. So it might well be that the assassin has been killed, who knows, but also someone else has been killed in order to fit them up as the assassin. Someone that whoever it is, maybe the mafia, wanted out of the way in the first place.
Well, I think it's
a double whammy, I suppose.
I think it's pretty clear that there's more going on here than meets the eye. And as I say, Whitney Webb's research going back to the 1940s in the US, it's not new, this stuff. relations between organised crime and intelligence services have been going on forever.
But particularly in this case, we're talking about Les Wexner and the Jewish mafia. I mean, should you call them the Jewish mafia, the Zionist mafia, the Israeli mafia? Who are these people?
Well, they are mafia, and they are some of the top people are Jewish, but I don't think they're very necessarily practicing Jews. A lot of mafia groups tend to have an ethnic basis because it's a basis of solidarity. There's an Albanian mafia, and of course Albanian's a rather obscure language, and therefore it's quite easy to keep things secret if you talk about it in Albanian, because nobody can understand what you're on about. And you know, it's the logic behind Cockney rhyming slang and all the rest of it. But when money's involved, you're bound to find that, you know, all sorts of different people will be involved.
It might also be that Deutsche Bank are very, very nervous about all this coming out, especially they're on a bit of a...
Well, Deutsche Bank is probably going to collapse, and it's probably the most over-leveraged bank in the world. And when it does, of course, it will pull down the financial system in an afternoon. It's pretty certain that that's what's going to happen. I don't think whether you're a left-wing or a right-wing economist, nobody is supposed to just pump up the stock market like we've been doing for the last 10 years. It's bound to lead to a crash. There's nothing else that can happen.
The Great Reset is... you keep talking about the war, but the Great Reset seems to be running parallel with this, potentially. That is the idea of a complete change in the international financial architecture. I think we should have a bit of a better look at that next week. But finally, Martin, for this week, the Ukrainian Nazis in The Guardian, this article that was removed. I don't know if you've seen that story.
I've seen it, yeah.
I mean, I looked for the article. I did see the article originally, but then I looked the day after and The Guardian had taken it down. I mean, it's actually a pro-Ukrainian Nazi article that The Guardian had published there.
Yeah, and it was picked up by Craig Murray, the former British ambassador of Uzbekistan, who's very involved in the Assange case.
The headline was stamps celebrating Ukrainian resistance in pictures, but those stamps happened to have Nazi symbols on them.
Yeah, they're basically, the Guardian has become a mouthpiece for British intelligence services, and they want to encourage the idea that the poor old Ukrainians have been oppressed by the Russians and now they're fighting back. And this is a picture from it's a picture from the 1940s from the Ukrainian.
But of course,
Nazi,
what's happening
Nazi
here
puppet state.
Is the Guardian is publishing pro-Nazi propaganda, and Craig Murray is calling them out. But Craig Murray himself is facing jail, isn't he? The former ambassador to Uzbekistan.
Well, he's being charged with contempt of court because of his involvement in the Alex Salmond's sexual harassment case. And, of course, I've read about this yesterday, Craig Murray is going to testify in the Spanish case against the private company, the security company, which basically bugged Assange when he was inside the Ecuadorian embassy. And the people in the Spanish teams that are looking into this, they've got the guy who's responsible. It's a Spanish private security company who did it under contract from the CIA. And they said they're absolutely obsessed with Ukraine. You know, basically they wanted to know what Craig Murray was doing. And of course, Craig Murray was the person who flew to Washington to pick up the MP3 of all of the emails.
The memory stick.
From the memory stick from the DNC computers, which showed that the...
So this is a story where we were told was the Russians hacking it. No, it wasn't. This was given to Craig Murray, who flew on a plane across the Atlantic with the data.
That's right, and then he flew back.
It was given voluntarily.
Yeah, it was probably given by Seth Rich, who was the head of IT at the DNC, who was probably a Bernie Sanders fan. And he was getting disgusted that it was all being rigged against him.
So much of what we're seeing.
And then, of course, he was assassinated. By somebody.
Seth Rich was, yeah.
Yeah, yes. And it was supposedly a robbery, but they didn't even bother to take his phone or his wallet.
I mean, it seems almost every week, more and more and more of our news stories are fussing about something that doesn't matter, or else they are simply there as cover stories for what really happened. So, you know, we're getting to the stage where increasingly watching the news, I don't know about you, Martin, if you ever do, but I'm sitting there thinking, well, we know what really happened here, and this is just a lie in order to try and cover it up. That's what the news is these days.
Well, I think what you'll find is that not everybody's got the time or the inclination or the training to look into things in the level of detail that we do on this show, which has been running for several hours now. Most people have to work hard. They get up early in the morning. they think they might have cancer, their children are going off the rails, they watch the news for half an hour a day, and they get a fairly distorted picture.
One good bit of news, Martin, we had our first pub visit this week. Have you been to the pub yet?
No.
Well, you should. I think you should, because it's quite interesting. You're not allowed to stand at the bar, but you can most definitely chat to people in there. There's quite a few people in the pub I went to in Kent. And lovely chatting with everyone. And actually, you know what? Most of the people in the pub were saying, this is madness, isn't it? This is just silly, you know. The idea that you're not allowed to stand at the bar, the idea that you've got to keep a certain distance away from people, there seemed to be quite a rebellious attitude. But the publican was basically resigned to it, saying, well, the only way I can make any money is to go along with all these rules. And it was actually a lovely atmosphere. I met some fantastic... And it's one of the lovely things about going to the pub is you meet people completely randomly. And, you know, you can make a friend in half an hour, in an hour, and never see the person again.
Yeah, well, I spoke to my friend in Cape Town this morning, and you wouldn't like it there because they've banned all alcohol sales and all cigarette sales, and they're in permanent lockdown.
Well, no, I wouldn't. No, I certainly wouldn't. And actually, that is designed to send people crazy, isn't it?
Well,
if you can't have any alcohol.
The justification has been that don't forget that South Africa is an incredibly violent place, and of an average.
Well, it's likely to be more violent now if people can't get their alcohol.
The level of shootings and accidents caused by alcohol in cars has gone down dramatically, but the downside of it is that the very powerful gangs who run the townships in South Africa have now taken over completely the supplying of alcohol and tobacco.
Yeah, well, that's actually exactly what happens when you prohibit this stuff, is it's fantastic for organised crime, which takes us right back to the Epstein story and the Jewish mafia. Well... time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican, Labour activist Martin Summers. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk, but you might not find it through Google. You might probably find another search engine instead. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Sunday evenings at 6 with Danny Lopsch is always a good listen. BCFM boss Pat Hart did our say, our sister show Dialect will be back on BCFM and Mondays at 10, but so far it hasn't appeared. This show may be back in November, but don't hold your breath, dear listeners. Do please join us though for the Politics Show live stream at the old time of 5 o'clock next Friday here on this very channel, PRSC Radio. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Centenario.
Straight in at number 3 on the DJ's choice, and most of the tracks in the charts are upbeat house records, and it's no real surprise because, as we know, Amsterdam is house nation of the world.